You know that if you turn the dial on your radio and on your TV set and on every news story, it has the same slant and it's the same stories. You know that the news and the media are controlled. If you don't, you're not playing with a full deck of cards. Okay? It is absolutely absurd to believe that all these different networks, news stations, newspapers, and radio stations are all owned by different people, yet they all carry the exact same stories every day, worded in the exact same way, with the same agenda and the same slant. You see, if they were all separate and independent, that could never happen in a million years because no two people ever attach the same importance to the same event or the same slant on the same story unless they're handed it.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news, again, it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers by the skin of his teeth, managing to re-find his Skype password. A bomb in the second hour in Beirut Harbour, or is it an accident? We discussed this enormous blast on Tuesday, which destroyed Lebanon's ability to trade. Deliberate or accident? And what if we've been lied to about the dangers of radiation? The Fukushima, ever since the models still do use today, which were created around the time of the Hiroshima blast. So this is the 75th anniversary of Hiroshima Day. We talked this week to Chris Busby, Dr. Chris Busby, about what he believes is the failed and flawed model for measuring the dangers of nuclear power plants today based on events at Hiroshima. And that, of course, includes Hinkley C. Plus, more on what the mass media are not telling you, such as the extraordinary release of the Ghislaine Maxwell court papers, which John Paul Rice from Hollywood, he's a producer, never mind the Me Too movement, he believes it exposes an evil paedophile ring in Hollywood, which he has witnessed as part of his work too, and he talks about that. Also, Bulgarian investigative journalist Ileana Gatasheva, she speaks in an exclusive interview to me this week. We heard from her last week about the biowarfare labs of the Pentagon. She speaks this week about her discovery of the arms pipeline to the so-called Syrian rebels. That's all in the second hour after six. But before all that, we revisit a story this programme covered way back in 2017. Now, the reason we're covering it in more depth is, or should be, clear. I couldn't use the most sensitive parts of the interview back in 2017 with Balogun, the St. Paul's-based human rights and anti-apartheid activist, because the BCFM station manager, Pat Hart, who's a friend of our present mayor, Marvin Rees, instructed me not to. Even what we used at the time, which was both legally sound and most definitely in the public interest, earned me a 3-week suspension by Pat Hart from the airwaves. So before we go back on FM and under Pat Hart's editorial control there, it makes sense to clear the air on this story. We heard last week about the death of St. Paul's illegal drug and drinking den owner Ajax. This week we go down Ashley Road to Grosvenor Road to give you a fuller picture of an alleged black-on-black attack at the height of the successful campaign, previously anyway, against apartheid, which was being run by one of St. Paul's firebrands, that's Ras Kumba Jahili Balogun, and an incident in 1997 where he alleges the present mayor Marvin Rees's father Valentine Walker, who owned a similar illegal drug and drinking club on the junction of Grosvenor Road and St Nicholas Road called the Crystal Dove. We hear tonight a refresher on Bristol's role in the 1980s resistance to apartheid and the Thatcher government, a regional news story also about Chief Constable Malcolm Popperwell, which made it into almost all the national newspapers, and the present mayor Marvin Rees's father's alleged attempt to kill Balogun and his trial for assault against Balogun. We also hear for the first time from Avonmouth activist Steve Norman, who subsequently died, and his assessment that the present Bristol mayor Marvin Rees was given special privileges at the time, even sent to Harvard University, eventually becoming mayor of Bristol because of what his father Valentine Walker did for the establishment. After I approached him in 2017 through the BCFM station manager Pat Hart, Valentine Walker, who now lives in Streatham, London, left a note for me in the BCFM studio 6 months ago, over 2 years later, purporting to be his phone number. Around the 7th of February, that happened a few weeks before our show was taken off FM. Was it a friendly gesture or an attempt to intimidate? How did Valentine Walker get access to our BCFM studio? Valentine replied to my call and my text by text a couple of weeks later, or a week or so later, on Valentine's Day, saying he might come and see me next time he was in Bristol. Well, I thanked him, looking forward to it, but I've heard nothing since. So if anyone knows Valentine, including station manager Pat Hart, do please let him know. I'm happy for him to tell his side of the story of the attack on Balagoon, alleged, of the trial, and of the accusations of being a police informer. As yet, I've heard nothing more from Valentine Walker, so I'll be airing the full story from Balagoon and Steve Norman's perspective tonight. The context is Valentine's 1987 alleged attempt to kill Balagoon and what Balagoon is doing now after being driven out of St. Paul's in the 1980s, living in Ghana. And the sacking also we'll be hearing about in the first hour of Dr. Mohamed Adil for, amongst other things, objecting at the time to the release of hospital patients to care homes, amongst other things. Also, he's claiming that the virus is not as dangerous as the government and mass media keep telling us he is. It is, even though he's been working in the NHS as a top consultant and even a registrar for 35 years, he's just been sacked as a doctor and he cannot now work in Britain. In order to make a living, he will have to go back to Pakistan. Anyway, Martin Summers, Irish Republican Labour activist, can you sum up your own thoughts and feelings about this event back in the 1980s in St. Paul's? Because at the time, there was quite a lot of very successful anti-apartheid activism going on. For example, one of the things I've heard anecdotally is that one night, on a Sunday night, 12 branches of Barclays Bank were attacked and they had their front windows smashed in the city all in the same night. And this is the bank that was dealing with South Africa. And that actually didn't get reported in the 1980s in the press at all.
Well, I can't say I've got first-hand knowledge of what was going on in Bristol in the 1980s. I was living in Brixton at the time, so I know what was going on there. And so far as anybody does, you know, just living somewhere doesn't mean you know what's going on. And I'm familiar with the story because obviously we've covered it before. You know, I wait to hear what you've got to offer.
Anyway, I thought we'd start with a recording of Steve Norman talking about something different. Just to introduce Steve, he died about 18 months ago, but Steve was a very, shall we say, a bit of a firebrand, a bit like Balagoon in a way, an activist. He was a former member of the Seamen's Union and an activist within the Merchant Navy. And Steve Norman, here he is talking about Terence Mordaunt and David Ord. These are these two merchant venturers who were so very powerful down at the Bristol port. And, of course, the former merchant venturer who then became mayor, George Ferguson, sold the port, sold the city's interest in the port to the Bristol Port Company for what Steve thought was actually a very small amount of money. So let's have a listen now to Steve talking about Bristol Port, which is where he lived down in Avonmouth.
They've got all the workshops, all the machinery, 2,600 and something acres of land, pockets of land all over Avonmouth.
2,000, that's a lot of land.
Yeah.
2,600 acres. If I don't know how I ought to be able to do my sums in my head, but you're talking, I would say for land like this, at the bare minimum, something like 50,000 an acre, maybe more, 100,000 an acre.
It would be more because Avonmouth's expanded under the South West Development Partnership. So as you go out from where we are stood now and go towards Seven Beach, where you had all the chemical works, ICI and what have you, they own pockets of land down there. Now, there are pockets of land, like on Cabot Park, that have been selling small, a couple of acres for 8 million, 9 million quid.
So, okay, we got a bad deal, I think.
We got a very bad deal, and the merchant venture's got a very good deal.
So that's Steve Norman there. Martin, also, we'll be hearing a bit more from him later, but can you just put this whole thing into context? The anti-apartheid struggle was really only one of various struggles that were going on in the 1980s under Margaret Thatcher. We also had the miners' strike. We had Wapping, We had the Battle of the Beanfield. It was a very tumultuous decade, which these events we're going to be talking about again in a minute were set up against, isn't it? Wasn't it?
It is, and it's also very important because it set the trend for what subsequently happened. I mean, things like the sale of council houses have created the and then the collapse of social housing provision have created a massive homelessness crisis, and that was all seeded in the 1980s. Thatcher's main crimes, in my view, were privatisation of things that shouldn't have been privatised, like the railways, which are subsequently coming back into public ownership, where they should always have been. The deregulation of the City of London in 1987, which led directly to the crash in 2008. And the third strand of wrong of which she did was the creation of Al-Qaeda and its training and arming by our own intelligence services. Nobody disputes that that's what happened. The story is that on 9/11, the people we'd trained and armed with our special forces and intelligence support turned on us and blew up the Twin Towers. That's rubbish. But of course, it was the Operation Cyclone that Margaret Thatcher was an enthusiastic participant in, which created the Islamist International Brigades, which we now claim to be scouring the planet to defeat, even though in actual fact, as we're going to hear in the second half, we've been arming them much more recently than the 1980s.
Yeah, the miners' strike was a big one, wasn't it? Because this is really about the country's energy supply. Whether or not you think that coal is a suitable thing now, certainly there's very few people now that think that coal's a good idea. So we're in a bizarre situation, aren't we, where most Labour members, most Labour MPs, certainly the shadow front bench and probably quite a lot of the other Greens and Tories too, now could look back at the miners' strike, Martin, and say, well, that was a good thing because it saved us from climate change.
No, well, I think the real issue in the miners' strike was the breaking of the trade unions. The NUM were the strongest union in Britain. And they basically, if you're going to run down an industry like coal, there's no reason to go at it like a bull at a gate. You gradually phase it out so that you limit the social impact. But there was an executive decision at the top. It was basically revenge for the two miners' strikes of 1972 and 1974, which basically, boxed in the Tory government and defeated them. And there was, from that moment on, there was a determination by the deep state in this country to break the NUM.
So am I right in thinking that the chief executive of British Coal at the time was an American, and also that there was infiltration of the National Union of Mine Workers right into the very centre of Arthur Scargill's committees?
Yeah, well, I mean, they brought over McGregor because he got a reputation for breaking unions in the US. He broke in the US miners' union at the AMAX coal combine in Kentucky. So it was quite clear what he was there for. And of course, Roger Windsor had infiltrated himself into the NUM and eventually made himself indispensable to Arthur Scargill. Arthur Scargill should have been smarter about that than he was, but there you go. And of course, he was the one who basically arranged the so-called trip to Libya to ask Gaddafi for money. And it's all in Seamus Milne's book, The Enemy Within, how close the NUM actually came to victory. And at one stage, apparently, Thatcher was in tears in a cabinet meeting because they were definitely going to lose. But they managed, in the end, to scrape it. I mean, I remember when NACODs, which are the supervisors, were balloted if they'd come out on strike. If they came out on strike, that would have been a complete close down of the coal industry. But they didn't do that. And of course, because they didn't, eventually it all went the other way. But you've got to remember how contingent history actually is. The idea that they were doomed to defeat is wrong. There were various mistakes made. But if they'd won, then we'd probably be living in a different country today than the one we are living in.
Yeah, there's another aspect to all of this. I mean, I mentioned these three, the two strikes, the printer workers' strikes, the miners' strike, and also the Battle of the Beanfield with the Traveller Peace Convoy being smashed the year after. Then there also, in 87, there was the dismemberment of the BBC, that is to say Seamus Milne's father, Alastair Milne, being removed as Secretary General by Victor Rothschild, who himself was very much involved, if you read Spycatcher and other books, in determining who was in charge of the security services. So this does seem as if Margaret Thatcher, to a large extent, handed quite a lot of power over those years to the security services to infiltrate and use dirty tricks to get her way.
Yeah, well, we know that from the 1960s onwards, the left in this country was systematically infiltrated, and all the stone paranoia that people used to get into, like, we're being infiltrated. We now know that that was true.
Well, they may have been branded as conspiracy theorists.
Yeah, well, I mean, the point about all of this, of course, is to create distrust and make it virtually impossible for people to organise politically and to fragment any opposition. And that's been going on continuously.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, you're talking there about creating a kind of hostile environment for democratic politics.
Yeah, well, I mean, the state doesn't just sit on its hands, and the corporate interests that the state represents don't just sit on their hands when people organise against them. And, we've had an armed struggle within the borders of this state, not just strikes, not just breaking windows in Barclays Bank. We've had two Tory prime ministers nearly assassinated by the Provisional IRA. So, this country has got a tradition of political conflict. It's, you know, people may think of it as some kind of backwater in terms of things like that, but it never has been and it still isn't.
Okay, so anyway, let's re-examine this story from a couple of years ago, going much more deeply into it today than we were able to do under the editorship of Pat Hart from BCFM and also at the time. So we'll start off really by having an extract from the interview with Balogun that I did from Ghana back in 2017, really putting this into context. What was going on in Bristol in the 1980s and then what was Bristol's anti-apartheid role?
Bristol was on the map because when Nelson Mandela was eventually released from prison, I was given an invitation immediately to go and meet him in a hotel in West London, where I brought all my family and other activists from other parts of the country. We all gathered there and met Nelson and Winnie Mandela and Tambo and the rest of them. So Bristol was on the map, and Bristol was clearly on the map because the St. Paul's Apartheid Free Zone campaign was an initiative that I went around the country with and established apartheid-free zones in Toxteth, in Moss Side, in Handsworth, in Hyson Green, in Brixton, you know, all across the country. It wasn't just an apartheid-free zone in Bristol. I went up and down the country and established apartheid-free zones on the same premise that they were organized here, organized there in Bristol. So Bristol was indeed on the map. And with the work that I did with the Labour Party, I spoke at Labour Party conference, moving motions at Labour Party conference. I was chairman of the Labour Party black sections, where we got the four MPs elected eventually, Diane Abbott, Keith Vaz, Paul Boateng, and Bernie Grant, who has since passed away. I was instrumental in those people being elected. Instrumental. Bristol was instrumental. I wasn't just the only person travelling from Bristol to London for black section meetings or other Labour Party meetings. There were other black people as well that were involved.
Yeah, so that's Balogun, the St. Paul's-based anti-apartheid activist. Martin, I mean, it does sound as if Bristol was playing a pretty important role there, and certainly from the Thatcher government's point of view, from the South African government's point of view, from the racists' point of view, that the activists in this city were going to be a target.
Quite likely, yeah. And, of course, Balogun first came to prominence because Bristol, St. Paul's, was where the big riots of 1981 began. So it started in St. Paul's. I was living in Brixton at the time. It spread to Brixton the next day. And then on the third day, it spread to Liverpool. So Bristol went first in that wave of...
Okay, he does talk about exactly what sparked those riots back in 81 in the interview I did with him. I'll put a full version of that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk once this program's been uploaded, probably about 9 or 10 o'clock this evening. But let's go on now to hear the accusations that, I mean, in fact, this is a story that came out initially to the local press, but it very quickly spread all over the nationals about the chief constable of Avon and Somerset Police, a guy in the 1980s called Malcolm Popperwell.
Malcolm Popperwell was a chief superintendent who led a racist drug raid into the community, I think in 1987. And he led that raid around the time where we were picking the kids from school. So you had grandfathers who were coming to pick their grandchildren, of course, mothers and fathers, sisters and brothers. And basically they made a big swoop in St. Paul's and just arrested everybody inside on the basis that they believed that they were either taking drugs or selling drugs. And obviously the drug, the main drug was cannabis. Basically, they had to release a lot of people because at the end of the day, these were just people who were just coming from school and picking their siblings and what have you. Now, I brought a lot of pressure to bear on Malcolm Popperwell, and eventually he had an heart attack. I think within 72 hours he had a heart attack. I was out on the front line, as it was called, then Grosvenor Road, and somebody, I don't know who it was, but we were talking, and somebody said, oh, we hope the bastard dies. So I picked the phone up, and I think it's the Evening Post I gave a call to, one of the reporters there. I had good rapport with the journalists back in those days, and they were always gunning for a good controversial story to sell their newspapers. And I just told them that this is, you know, Kwame Jai Balogun here, and on behalf of the black community, we hope that Malcolm Popperwell dies. Now, the next morning, I had the real paparazzi outside the house. I didn't know it had blown up that big. I was front page of every single British newspaper on that day. I opened the front door and the flash from the camera was just going, and I quickly shut the door and made a phone call and said, I've got all these photographers outside. And someone said, haven't you seen the papers? And I said, no. I said, you're front page. Hope the bastard dies. So eventually, I decided that I've got to go out there, jump in the car, and go to the newspaper shop. And I got up there on to City Road. I told the guy, oh, let me have every single newspaper. I could see my picture on every single newspaper. And I bought every single one and went to the community association where my office was. Now, politically, it probably wasn't the right thing to be done. When you talk about political correctness. But my allegiance was to the black community. It wasn't to the establishment. It wasn't to the institutions that did their best to criminalize us, you know, and put a 6 foot six in the grave. It was to the black community. And I echoed what the black community felt. And I didn't realize the implications of it, of course. I was naive with that statement, but once again, it's one of those things that I would do again. I've got no problem.
So that's Balogun speaking to me about 2.5 years ago. And now we get to the point which is the part of the interview which I couldn't air at the time, partly because of the pressure from Pat Hart, the station manager, but also, of course, because it contradicts the results of a court case which took place at the time. Martin, the idea of broadcasting one side of the story might seem, I mean, this is after, remember, well, long, long after this court case is finished, is surely it's okay. I mean, what I've done is I've approached Valentine Walker directly and asked him, and he doesn't want to give his point of view. So it just seems to me that we've got to give the point of view which we've already recorded with Balogun.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're online now, and the rules are a bit different. You know, Ofcom does not regulate what we're doing at the moment, so let's hear what he's got to say.
Well, I mean, I'm saying more than that, really. I'm saying, well, we have a duty to report this stuff one way or another, and, of course, there are certain caveats you'd have. This is most clearly Balogun's specific personal point of view. But I just want to make it absolutely clear that I have approached Valentine, first of all through Pat Hart, and then directly in order to try and get his point of view. He doesn't seem to want to give his point of view, rather other than leave a little note for me in February in the BCFM studio on the table with his number, and then really not get back to me. And I think it might be good before we hear this, just to hear the actual article which appeared, or one of the articles which appeared about the court case that transpired after this incident. And that was published on April the 9th, 1988, in The Guardian. I believe the incident took place at the end of 1987. The headline is, "Community Worker is Cleared of Machete Attack on Rastafarian." So a jury yesterday cleared a, there's no actual byline on this, a jury yesterday cleared a community worker on charges of attacking Rastafarian Mr. Koumba Balogun with a machete. Earlier, Mr. Balogun, aged 26, was fined £150 by the judge at Bristol Crown Court for turning up late on the second day of his trial. He wasn't on trial. Mr. Justice Smithies told his counsel, Mr. Ian Glenn, a fine would be a proper way of expressing public disapproval. So Smithies is the trial judge. The judge also ordered Mr. Balogun to pay £100 towards his defence costs, but Mr. Glenn said he did not intend to claim them. The jury found Mr. Valentine Walker, aged 36, of Robertson Road, Eastern Bristol, not guilty of unlawfully wounding Mr. Balogun with intent. So it wasn't an attempted murder charge or manslaughter. It was, the charge was unlawfully wounding with intent. An alternative charge of unlawful wounding was also dismissed. The prosecution claimed that Mr. Walker, former vice chairman of the St. Paul's Community Association, so that's Valentine, was former vice chairman of the St. Paul's Community Association, of which Mr. Balogun is now chairman, had stuck a 2-foot 6-inch machete into Mr. Balogun's neck. Mr. Mark Horton, prosecuting, said the blow came within 1 centimetre of severing his jugular vein. Now, that makes it quite clear, and this is me, not the article, saying that it came very close to dying as a result of that. Obviously, if it had severed his jugular vein, he probably wouldn't still be alive today, Balogun. Okay, so the court was, carrying on with the article, the court was told Mr. Balogun did not initially report the incident to the police and discharged himself from the Bristol Royal Infirmary after treatment. In his address to the jury, Mr. Nicholas O'Brien, who was defence counsel for Valentine Walker, said, "Mr. Balogun is an evil man who does not share society's standards or values. Mr. Walker did not appear during the 2-day hearing. The judge said that an arrest warrant still stood, but was now with bail, so that he would not have to be immediately arrested when found." So that's the article from The Guardian of the 9th of April 1988. Now let's hear from Balogun himself and his account of the attack on him.
"The people who didn't like what I was doing in St. Paul's was the establishment, pure and simple. It was the establishment. They worked through people like Valentine Walker. He was a known informer. Let me tell you, quite straight. He was a known informer in the area. He was telling the police about various people who were doing this, who were doing that.
Do you have any evidence for that?
No, but I'm still saying it. I didn't go with him when he met with police officers and what have you, but it's not going to stop me from saying it. I said it when we even went to trial on this issue that we're going to discuss now. So, I knew him to be a police informer, and lots of people in our community knew him to be a police informer. And in fact, things were going so well in the community. I'd organized the community so well to the point where if I said, yes, let's go and demonstrate at Avon County Council, we'd get hundreds. If I said, let's demonstrate at Bristol City Council, we'd get hundreds. If I said, let's have a vigil on St. Paul's Green, we'd get hundreds. It was disturbing to the establishment. It was something that disturbed them. There were lots of single issue based campaigns. I mean, we did vigils to support the apartheid struggle in South Africa, for example. We did vigils when they were going to execute people in South Africa. We did, and lots of different things. There were lots of issues there. I organized the St. Paul's Apartheid Free Zone, where we got all the shops to stop stocking and selling goods that was South Africa. That took a time. I closed down the Barclays Bank that was on Newfoundland Road. We used to picket it every Wednesday. It would get about 30 or 40 people, and we used to stand in the queue. And when it got to our turn, we used to say stuff like, you know, we don't want any more blood money in South Africa. Leave South Africa. Then we disrupted the business every Wednesday of Barclays Bank. We used to do sittings in there. The police used to come, used to lift us out and put us on the pavement outside, and we used to just go back in. The bank couldn't cope with it. Eventually, they closed the building, you know. They closed that institution in St. Paul's. So the establishment was so upset with what was going on that they had to find a way to destabilize the community, and they did with the introduction of cocaine. And they introduced cocaine and hard drugs through people like Valentine Walker. You know, these were the people who first came into the community with cocaine. I didn't even know what it was. I didn't know what heroin was, but it was mainly the cocaine. And they brought the cocaine into our community, destabilizing everything, and then they were able to pick people off. There was no unity again. We were fighting against each other.
Okay, and tell us about this altercation with Valentine and how it, you know, what transpired afterwards.
Well, he came into my office because I had another office called the St. Paul's Local Development Agency. And that was sponsored by the Tory government. They gave me £100,000 a year to establish black businesses. It was something that was supported by Prince Charles. It was his trust. And basically, I was running that agency, and I was assisting young African Caribbean men and women in establishing, you know, SMEs, small, medium enterprises. And I was in that office one morning when Valentine Walker came in with a gun and started, you know, talking about, oh, you think you're the big boss in the area and I'm going to show you and all this kind of stuff and what have you.
When was this?
Probably 87. I'm 87, I would say. But he came in with his gun. I was sitting behind my desk upstairs. And, you know, started waving the gun about, you know, what I'm going to do to you and all this kind of stuff and what have you. And then he left. You know, I called a friend and told a friend that, look, this guy just came up, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, we decided, okay, you know, hold tight, sit tight, and we'll take it from there.
Well, did you not think to phone the police?
Oh, come on. What would the police do? The police are the people who sent him. They sent him. I called the police and told them what? The guy you sent to come and kill me has actually arrived. What would they do? They wouldn't do anything. The police were totally against me. So he came back, and he came back with a machete, which is a rather long knife that is used in the Caribbean. It's used for weeding and what have you. You know, it's used in Africa and stuff like that. And he made a swipe at me and cut my fingers because I put my hand up to protect myself. And then he went again as if he was coming to hack me. And then he changed the stroke halfway through and pushed it in my throat. When he withdrew the blade, obviously a lot of blood just splattered out. And he ran out of the room saying, you can tell your friends, blah, 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 I'll be waiting. So anyway, to be honest with you, I traveled to Northern Ireland, and they taught me a number of things. And one of the things they taught me is whenever you get a wound, just take it easy. Don't start panicking. Just take your time, cool the adrenaline down, so you can control the amount of blood that's going to leave your body. And that's exactly what I did. I took my time, I walked to the bathroom, I saw the extent of the damage, I held both the skin together at my throat, and took my time and came downstairs and went to the shop next door and asked them to call the ambulance for me. And then I sat on the windowsill there and just waited. The ambulance came in about 3 minutes, but the nature of the cut was so severe that before I got to the hospital, they'd stitched it all up. Of course, they had the police coming round, who did it, what was this, this and that, blah, blah, blah. There was a lot of pressure. because I had the locals in the community saying, don't say anything, we'll deal with it on our own. I had, you know, the politicians from the Labour Party saying, you must be seen to be using the system, and the system must be seen to be assisting you. So don't deal with it on your own. Tell the police everything. And, you know, it was a very traumatic time. I was released from the hospital. I don't know how much stitches I had. The friends came round, politicians came round. We all had a talk. And I tried to make a compromise by doing both things, which was telling the police eventually who it was, and then also trying to deal with it on my own. I told the police, and Valentine Walker didn't waste any time. He left the country and went to Jamaica, and he stayed there throughout the entire trial, because there was a trial. And
what, you mean his own trial?
Yeah.
So he was on trial even though he was in Jamaica?
Yeah. I think he must have turned up once to court or something. And I told the court that, yes, this is the guy that did it. And
was he at any point arrested?
Yeah, he was arrested. He was eventually arrested. He was arrested. And that's how, we, you know, the charges came up against him and what have you. But at the end of the day, he probably attended court once or twice, and then he fled to Jamaica. And in his absence, he was found not guilty. And it was determined that I'd cut my throat myself and blamed it on him because I was saying he was a police informant. Now, that was totally, absolutely unbelievable. But that's the way it went. You know, I wanted to accept it like that. Soon he was back in the community doing what he was doing. I was still there doing what I was doing as well. And I just had to live with it like that.
I mean, did you pass him in the street, that sort of thing?
No, not often. Not often. He travelled with, he moved around with a couple of other guys. And on one occasion that I was going to sort something out, something else happened and it deterred the whole thing. So basically, he got away with that. And, you know, I've just had to live with that.
I mean, so what with the introduction of cocaine and this incident as well, which seems like on the surface anyway is a miscarriage of justice, how did that affect, you know, the cohesion of the community in St. Paul's?
Well, the cocaine totally destroyed the cohesion in the community, totally destroyed, because we hadn't known anything about that before. We were just smoking cannabis. That was about it.
So I mean, how does the drug affect? It. I mean, how does the drug affect people in a political way?
Well, they began to feel that there was no hope. There was no point pursuing things politically at all. They even told me they felt I was barking up the wrong tree. It would be a waste of time and good energy. No one was going to listen to you. No one's going to take you seriously. No one was going to address the issue of poor housing, poor education, poor health care, you know, lack of employment, lack of, you know, recreational facilities. No one was going to address those things anymore because nobody cared. All they wanted for us was to be locked up in Lockleys prison. And that's what was happening. And when the cocaine came into the community, it swiftly turned people against each other, because once people got hooked on it, that was it. They were selling everything just to get a hit, and they were taking, you know, a rock on credit, stuff like that. And when they couldn't pay, then whoever you took it from came down on you like a sledgehammer coming to smash a nut. So, you know, the cohesion was totally destroyed. People became disillusioned once again, apathetic once again, and they didn't realize that they had a reason for living, you know. So it was very, very bad. It was a very, very bad situation. And I don't believe that St. Paul's has even recovered from that, because we've had a lot of black-on-black violence. We've had a lot of people who've been killed, and and what have you. And, you know, the area has been gentrified now, and black people are being driven from St. Paul's because it's next door to the town centre, and black people essentially have been dispersed. And they congregate now in pubs here and there and what have you. And the type of cohesion we had back in the early 80s, I don't think that will ever return to St. Paul's again.
Well, that's Balagoon, you interviewed 18 months ago. Martin, you know, it's sort of amazing, I think, to listen back to this. And in a way, the heart of what he's saying there, and that part of the interview is the one we couldn't air earlier because of, well, potentially, basically because the station manager didn't want us to. But, I mean, the thing is, at the end of the day, you know, when there is a miscarriage of justice, at least apparent miscarriage of justice like this, you do have to talk about it with the people involved. And it's quite clear that Valentine Walker hasn't wanted to be, he's the other side of this story, hasn't wanted to be, and I would still encourage Valentine, if he's listening to this, do get in touch. We want to hear your version of events. But what he's describing there, Martin, is really the smashing and demoralisation of an extremely active political community.
Yeah. I mean, just leaving aside the specific allegations, because obviously that depends upon what specifically happened and who's telling the truth. But it's quite clear that the introduction of crack cocaine in particular in the late 1980s in Britain and in the US caused all kinds of problems. And we now know in the US there's a film called Dark Alliance, which is based on the investigations of Gary Webb, who was based in California, that the CIA, through the Nicaraguan Contras and Adolfo Carrero, were bringing in massive amounts of cocaine into the inner cities in the US in that era, because it demoralized the local community, as there's a police officer,
Mike Rupert, don't you?
Mike Rupert also investigated
This. He stood up to John Deutsch, who was the CIA director.
People can find this on YouTube. Mike Rupert, who was a LAPD police officer, stands up at a meeting where John Deutsch, the deputy director of the CIA, is there, and this room is full of black parents who are furious because it's been uncovered that the CIA are involved in drug trafficking. And
Mike says, to remind us of that, CIA.
Now,
what Mike is saying, Martin,
likely that similar things were going on in Britain. And
what Mike is saying, Martin, let me just make it clear here, is that he was actually at South Central Los Angeles. He was a senior police officer there, and he is testifying in front of this public meeting and with the CIA boss there too, that the CIA is dealing drugs in this city, and he is a police officer saying this as a testimony. Well, it was quite sad because he committed suicide around about, I think it was probably 10 years ago now, but he made his mark, didn't he, while he was around still?
Well, Gary Webb, who was a journalist who investigated it all, he mysteriously committed suicide by shooting himself twice in the head, as you do. But in any case, as I say, there's a Hollywood film being made about all of this called Dark Alliance, and anybody can look into it. The Iran-Contra affair was really about cocaine importation into the United States, mainly from Colombia. But it was all being organized by the Contras in Nicaragua, who are basically a terrorist formation. And the Congress was Democrat-controlled at the time in the US, had forbidden the Reagan administration to supply them with weaponry. So they got around that by allowing them to deal drugs, which then gave them a slush fund to buy the necessary weaponry to overthrow the democratically elected government of Nicaragua, which was twice re-elected. And ultimately they succeeded by killing up to 30,000 people.
I mean, this isn't just about, it's not just about St. Paul's or any of the other minority ethnic communities around Britain. It's also about international drug smuggling. So it's a kind of double-edged sword, really. One, on the one hand, it's destroying political activism in these communities. And on the other hand, it's also raising vast sums of money for criminal black projects. Slush funds.
Yeah, and of course, it's got to remain illegal because otherwise it won't work. So all of the stuff about Reagan going, just say no, war on drugs, all of that. At the same time, people like Colonel Oliver North were involved in this drug dealing. And of course, Colonel Oliver North hasn't been to prison. He was pardoned for his role in all of this by George Bush Sr., because at the end of their term, presidents can pardon up to 200 people, whatever they've done, including murder. It's a pretty bizarre rule, but there it is. And of course, far from being regarded as a pariah, he is actually a great American hero, and he goes around to talk on TV and all the rest of it about the wonderful Reagan administration and his fantastic role in it all.
He talks to things like Pentecostal Christian services in great big halls and things like that.
That's right. But in actual fact, he's A, drug dealer, and B, a terrorist and a murderer. Now, you can see why people like Balagoon, when he gets attacked by Valentine, he doesn't go to the police. Nobody in Northern Ireland would go to the police either in those years for the same sort of reason.
Okay.
Now, things have changed since then, but that's how it was back then. And that's how people perceived it.
Well, things have changed, Martin. Maybe things have changed because of the fact that the very focused activism of St. Paul's has gone away. And that was that seemed to be the reason why the police were so hostile, or were persuaded to be so hostile and apparently racist in those days.
Well, look, frankly, the police back in Brixton when I lived in the 1980s were unprofessional racists. I won't put too fine a point on it.
Okay.
I saw loads of incidents where they were completely out of order. But, of course, they've learnt their lesson to some extent, because in actual fact, that provoked all of the uprisings and, burnings of the inner cities and so on. And they took a step back and thought, hang on a minute, we're losing control of this. And modern police claim to be... to have transcended that era. That's a claim.
Well,
claims that there is no institutional racism in the Metropolitan Police.
Some will say that the drugs and the racist policing have now served its purpose.
Well, I'd say that in actual fact, the same things are still going on, and on a bigger scale. This was just the beginning of it all. The modern drugs industry is far bigger than it was back in those days.
Yeah.
And the CIA is still in it up to their eyeballs. In Afghanistan, the US planes fly from Afghanistan to Camp Bondsteel in Kosovo, which is the biggest US military base in Europe. And from there, drugs are distributed all throughout Europe. And, of course, loads of people know this. But, of course, we all pretend that the government's against drugs and we've just got to obey the police and everything will be all right.
Well, it sounds to me as if, we're dealing with organised crime at the very highest levels. But anyway, let's go now and have a listen to listen to Steve Norman. And this is an interview I did with Steve at the time, which I didn't air at the time, where he talks about his views on this whole business, including whether or not Valentine Walker was a police informer.
I got information from an ex-copper confirming that, it was well known that Valentine was in the pocket of some police. I got it in a text, well known that Valentine was in the hands of some coppers. The guy's story needs to be told.
It's the wrong story, Steve. It's the wrong story.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, Tim, the story's going to get out.
You sent me some press cuttings.
Balagoon sent them to me.
Oh, did he? Okay. Interesting, one of them was that where his archive was stolen of all the articles about him.
Yeah.
So they were trying even then to erase history. Somebody was.
My people are marvelling now as a direct result of what his dad done for the establishment. My conspiracy theorist. You're trying to tell me that Marvis was showing you loads of St. Paul's, and I'm Einstein.
Who was it that decided that he needed to be sent to Harvard?
It's payback time for your man, wasn't it? Marvin was 16, he was born in 72. All of a sudden, he's got his rise to the top, out of nowhere. He sits alongside Guildford Fuller, where he was sick.
Well, yeah, same time roughly, isn't it?
Well, it sits alongside it. It's a grave miscarriage of justice.
We need to make sure that wrong is righted.
I agree with you, whatever the cost, whatever price. I've had a number of conversations with him, and the guy bears no malice. He just wants the truth out there. You know, Andy Burkitt was his boss, didn't you?
He just wants the truth out there. Well, that's right. Balogun still does want the truth out there. So he's saying there, Martin, where Marvin, that's our present mayor, is now, is a direct result of what his dad did for the establishment. That's what Steve Norman is saying there. And he could be right, couldn't he, that Marvin sort of went onto this conveyor belt back when he was 15, 16 years old, to Harvard and places like that. And it looks as if the establishment were maybe rewarding Valentine Walker for his actions in closing down the anti-apartheid movement in St. Paul's.
Well, Marvin told me years ago about his father, and he also said that he had nothing to do with him for many years. He was brought up largely by his mother, who's a Welsh nursery teacher, and he was brought up spent a lot of his childhood in refuges, keeping away from Valentine. And in many ways, Marvin Rees has defined himself really as being against that kind of person. He's very highly educated. He was always a bright little boy. I know people who knew him when he was small, and he was always going to succeed despite the difficulties of his background. And what Marvin Rees himself has said, as you know, he doesn't particularly correspond with this program, but I mean, but he told me years ago that he doesn't make it a secret that his dad is who he is. But on the other hand, he doesn't boast it from the rooftops either, because he doesn't actually have much to do with him. He's got a completely different family life. He's a churchgoer, and he's certainly nothing like his father.
Okay, so let's have a listen now, finally, to another clip of Balogun, really talking about who he is now. Who is he? Who was he, and who is he now? He's working in Ghana in the football world.
What people don't know is that I didn't actually know my parents. I didn't actually know my real parents. And my mother died when I was 9 months, and I didn't know my father. And basically, my roots were in West Africa. And I was fortunate enough to link up with some people after I was told what had actually happened, because this was kept from me for, 20-odd years. I didn't know the truth. And a lady I still know to be my mother, even though she's passed away, wasn't actually my mother. But God bless her soul, because she did her best for me. And I'm happy with what she's done, because she made me a very, very, very strong man. And so I was able to trace roots back to the Ashanti Kingdom, Nsuta Manpo. And that's where I went to stay. Having got there, I was a licensed coach. I'm a licensed football coach. I qualified at West Ham Football Club. And I'm also a level one and level two coach educator, a former referee as well. And so I came home and I thought, well, let me get involved in football. I was doing football, and because of, they say because I could articulate myself well in English, I also became a part of the media, and I'm considered one of the leading media personnel here in the country now. I've produced and directed my own television shows, radio shows. I've won awards for writing columns in newspapers and stuff like that. And so life just goes on. I'm in Ghana, and I'm doing what I like to do, and I'm fighting the challenges that are here too, because no matter where you go, you will find challenges, and there are a lot of challenges in Ghana.
Were you driven out of Bristol?
Yes, I was. I was driven out. I had to leave. First and foremost, I had so much hate mail as a result of linking up with Sinn Féin, the political wing of the IRA. I mean, mail was coming through my door that was addressed to the chief monkey, Monkeyville, St. Paul's, Bristol. The postman was delivering those type of mails through my door. And I've had, extra excrement come through the door, and lots of different threats. We're going to kill you. We're going to kill your wife. We're going to kill your kids. Lots of different things. And eventually it was decided that I had to leave Bristol. I didn't want to leave, but I had no choice, because it was quite clear that Valentine had tried to kill me. It wasn't successful. But there were going to be other attempts on my life. And so we had a caucus, especially within the Labour Party. And we did one or two things to ensure that I would get accommodation in London, that I would be employed in London. And so I left Bristol. And, I mean, you know, that was it.
I mean,
but I've got no regrets about the whole thing. It's been a wonderful experience. I've learned a lot through the experience about myself, as much as I've learned about the institutions. I have no regrets at all about anything that has gone on in my life whatsoever. It's all played a significant part in my life, and it makes me who I am today.
Well, that's the voice of Balogun. Now, Nana Kwaku Angaman has changed his name. But anyway, I think it's quite nice, I think, Martin, to clear the air with this story, to do bring people up to date, I suppose, with the side of it which we weren't able to report at the time, simply because we didn't have the other side of the story. Now we've at least made an attempt to speak to Valentine, and he hasn't given his side. At the end of the day, though, the bigger picture here, in a way, is that we're facing another apartheid, aren't we, at the moment, here in 2020, and that is Israeli apartheid. There doesn't really seem to be quite such a strong anti-apartheid campaign with the present issue. In fact, it's the opposite. The Israelis and the Israel lobby seems to be working very, very powerfully and closely and cleverly in order to shut down any kind of discussion or debate about Israel here.
Yeah, well, you'll find that the political regime in South Africa are not very happy about that. They've taken a consistently hostile stance to Israel's apartheid policies, and they basically see the two struggles as analogous. And of course, the propaganda wing of the Israeli state is much more sophisticated than the propaganda wing of apartheid South Africa. But ultimately, they're defending the indefensible, and there's going to be consequences. And the obvious consequences would be sanctions. And I think, it won't take much to push popular opinion all over the world into, if we're going to have sanctions on Russia for Crimea and sanctions on Iran for what they supposedly didn't do, why not sanctions on Israel? Why not? And of course, the answer is that the deep state in the West is utterly infiltrated by all of this. And, we're all being dragged by the nose into a potential world war. In some ways, the Israeli situation is far more dangerous than apartheid South Africa, which was a kind of residual colonial holdout. The Israelis are at the cutting edge of forcing us towards World War III.
I mean, we've heard a lot from Black Lives Matter, but not a lot from them about the Israeli apartheid.
Well, in actual fact, I mean, Black Lives Matter is a big amorphous movement. The idea that it's some kind of, they've got a line on anything. You've got different groups who say different things. But lots of people who are active in that have said, yes, we recognise the Israelis are an apartheid state, etc. And it's at that point that lots of the more mealy-mouthed, middle of the road site people started to walk away from Black Lives Matter. I mean, Palestinian Lives Matter. I mean, the Israeli snipers were shooting down the protesters outside, peaceful protesters trying to march out of the Gaza prison camp, and they've shot hundreds of them. That's each one of those is a George Floyd, you know.
Okay, so let's look at some other stories before we go on to look at COVID. Craig Murray this week, Martin. US, as an article in the United States, the CIA is obsessed with Craig Murray's upcoming testimony in the Assange case. Now, this, I think, is quite important because Craig Murray, the former ambassador to Uzbekistan, has been the most vehement supporter. And in fact, he's an extremely professional guy in that he was, for example, the top maritime lawyer at the Foreign Office for a while, and as a former ambassador, he's been very forensic and almost as a defense lawyer or a defense advisor to Assange. Apparently the CIA are obsessed with him. He himself, though, puts most of the blame on the British security services, and now he himself is being tried for contempt of court for commenting on the Alex Salmond case. But anyway, it seems to me as if, you know, there seems to be a focus on the Salmond case when really what this is about is persecuting an ongoing miscarriage of justice against Julian Assange.
Well, of course, it was Craig Murray who cooperated with WikiLeaks. He flew to the United States to take the memory stick, which had all of the internal emails of the DNC on it, the Democratic National Committee, which showed that they were deliberately rigging the primary system against Bernie Sanders. And in actual fact, I just read earlier, before we came on air, that Seth Rich, who was probably the leaker, he was the head of IT at the Democratic National Committee. He was not happy with the way things were going, and he was probably the leaker. And the court, which is investigating his murder, because he was murdered by a supposed robbery where they didn't take his phone or his wallet, there's some investigation going on into that. And the judge investigating that wants Julian Assange to testify about where they got these emails from, because it wasn't hacked by the Russians. It was stolen by an insider.
I mean, that does seem peripheral, Martin. That seems like a very peripheral to the actual case, whatever it is, an inquest or whatever they're doing in the United States over Seth Rich, because surely the judge's job there is just to look at the circumstances there. Murray's apparently also in this article, I'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, the CIA obsessed with Craig Murray's upcoming testimony in the Assange case, just come out this week. Murray had offered to give evidence to special counsel Robert Mueller, who spent $32 million of government money investigating a conspiracy between the Russian government and the Trump campaign, which came to nothing, and including the allegation that Russia hacked the Democratic National Committee computer and turned the emails from the DNC and John Podesta over to WikiLeaks, which published them. So the interesting thing here is Craig Murray's offered to give evidence to Robert Mueller, and Robert Mueller has simply just not even acknowledged that he sent him a letter, and he's not interested in hearing from Murray.
Well, WikiLeaks, Murray included, and Julian Assange, they know where those emails came from. And in actual fact, WikiLeaks offered a reward for any information relating to the death of Seth Rich. They haven't openly come out and said that's where they got it from, because one of the things, the ways WikiLeaks works, is that if you tell us stuff in confidence, we won't spill the beans about you. But of course, since Seth Rich is dead, spilling the beans about him won't do him any harm. And of course, ultimately, what this is we're dealing with high-level criminals who behave in criminal ways, who rig elections, and then when they get found out, they assassinate people.
But we're talking here, aren't we? We're talking here about Scotland too. So, you know, somebody is going after Craig Murray simply for reporting on the Alex Salmond trial, even though actually it seems to be a way of basically getting at him for other things he's done.
Well, that's right. I mean, there's a court case in Spain at the moment where the Spanish authorities have arrested a Spanish security company because they got the contract from the CIA to bug the Ecuadorian embassy and get loads of inside information about both Craig Murray and Julian Assange. But they've been busted in Spain because you're not supposed to, because they were basically, you know, bugging things like Assange's discussions with his lawyers, which are supposed to be sacrosanct. But they're standing trial, and Murray is going to go to Spain to testify in that case. And
okay.
All of this skullduggery is all of a piece, and it's all linked together.
Okay, final story, or maybe final story, before we look at COVID on Serco, because there's a couple of scandals surrounding them, never mind all the scandals in the past where they've had to pay hundreds of millions of pounds in fines for lying, such as when they were being paid by the Home Office for thousands of people who were supposed to be on tags, even though their sentences had finished and they weren't on tags. Serco were being paid anyway. Worth mentioning that it's Rupert Soames, who's the chief executive of Serco, the brother of Nicholas Soames, who's the son of Sir Winston Churchill, former Tory Prime Minister. But also, Nicholas Soames is the guy that apparently phoned up Princess Diana and threatened her with her life before she died. But Rupert Soames' company, Serco, is involved in a couple of ways. First of all, in this contact tracing app and the contact tracing system, which seems to be roundly failing, but also with the housing of migrants across the town, across the country, and putting them up in hotels. So there is a suggestion by Nigel Farage, Martin, not your favourite person, but what he's saying here is this is a really a conflict of interest. What you've got is someone who's very close to the Conservative Party, who's actually standing to gain a fantastic amount through putting up asylum seekers who then come across and economic migrants, and there's no prospect of them going home. So this may be why we've seen these waves and waves, something like 3,000 since the beginning, or 4,000 since the beginning of the lockdown, of illegal migrants being ferried by the mafia across the channel into the UK, straight into the hands of Serco, and money going into the coffers of Rupert Soames.
Yeah, but you've got to distinguish between refugees and asylum seekers and economic migrants. Some people who come in across the channel probably are economic migrants, others are not. They're coming from war zones. Now, that's a separate issue. What's clearly going on is this is a government of crony capitalists. Loads and loads of the coronavirus crisis has given a huge opportunity for government to hand out contracts, millions of dollars of contracts, billions of pounds of contracts, to mates with no competitive
tender. Yeah, actually, Craig Murray
on the basis that it's an emergency and they haven't got time.
Well, that's right. Craig Murray has pointed this out too, hasn't he? Craig Murray pointed this out, that we've also got a face mask contract being handed to a friend of the Conservative Party, and those face masks are proving, many of them proving inadequate.
Yep. And of course, you've got Robert Jenks, who's now the housing minister, who says he's going to rip up the planning regulations brought in by the Labour government in 1945. So get the economy moving again, of course. But just incidentally, it means that Richard Desmond, for example, was going to be given a permission to build his luxury flats complex in Tower Hamlets and avoid paying 20 million to the wards local infrastructure. This particular Conservative government is a government of spivs. They always were spivs, but these people really are the bottom of the barrel.
Okay, well, let's just go north of the border now to Aberdeen, where there's been this Aberdeen cluster, they call it, and a lockdown in Aberdeen. The interesting figures around this, I think, are to do with this place called the Hawthorne Bar in Holborn Street in Aberdeen. The pub said the outbreak was linked to customers who visited on the 26th of July. There are 13 new cases. None of them are showing anything more than no symptoms or mild symptoms after having been tested, but the whole town has been locked down. There are no deaths been reported in Scotland with any coronavirus for 3 weeks, and yet Aberdeen is being locked down. So let's have a listen now to Nicola Sturgeon, the First Minister of Scotland, announcing this lockdown earlier this week.
I can confirm that it was agreed at SCOR this morning, albeit, as I'm sure you understand, extremely reluctantly, to reimpose some restrictions on the Aberdeen city area. And I want to set out what those restrictions are. Though let me remind you, because I know particularly for people living in Aberdeen, there will be lots of questions, that we will make more detail available over the course of the day to give as much clarity to people as possible. But firstly, our travel guidance to people in Aberdeen from today is that you should no longer travel more than 5 miles for leisure or recreational purposes. You may continue to travel for work or education, but we advise against other travel. We're also advising people who are not in Aberdeen not to travel to Aberdeen. If you are already in Aberdeen visiting family or on holiday, you can stay. But please follow all of the guidance while you're there and take extra care when you return home. Secondly, from today, people in Aberdeen should not go into each other's houses. Extended household groups can continue, but remember, these are situations which should only involve one other adult who is living on their own. And finally, we will be introducing regulations. We will publish these later today, requiring all indoor and outdoor hospitality in the city to close by 5 p.m. today. That includes all bars, restaurants, cafes and pubs. Hotel restaurants can remain open, but to provide food for residents only, and takeaway services can continue, but all other pubs and restaurants and cafes must close. This restriction on hospitality will be backed by regulation, so if necessary, it will be enforced. But I would expect, given the responsible way they have behaved in recent days, the owners of these businesses in Aberdeen will act voluntarily and continue to be responsible. And I want to thank businesses in the hospitality trade for their cooperation so far.
So that's First Minister of Scotland and Nicola Sturgeon there announcing this extra lockdown in Aberdeen. There's an element of absurdity to this, Martin, because nobody is actually ill in Aberdeen.
Yeah, but we know that there is asymptomatic transfer of the virus. So if you're going to I mean, what they're going for in Scotland is zero virus, just like they've got in New Zealand. What they're going for in England is minimising the virus.
Journalist Peter Hitchens says the most common symptom of COVID-19 is that you feel just fine. Huge numbers of those now being absurdly listed as infected with this bogeyman disease are perfectly healthy. If the trained hunters of the government's National Panic Service had not tracked them down, most of them would never have known they were supposed to be ill. Why do we take this seriously? It's a fact, not a conspiracy theory, that the power of the state is now being used to keep us in conditions of perpetual alarm. We're ceaselessly threatened with a second wave, for which there is, in fact, no evidence. So there is an element here, Martin, of something rather absurd and bizarre, where no longer is there any interest in people either being ill or dying from this disease. Just the very fact that a disease might be there, and there are questions about these tests, which we'll hear about in a minute, whether they're actually delivering false positives. It sounds to me as if it's becoming more and more difficult for people to trust what this government are saying.
Which government, the Scottish government or the English government?
Either.
Well, Peter Hitchens, as you well know, is an opinionated right-wing journalist. He's got his views. Nicola Sturgeon
just a minute. You can't just say that. He's absolutely quite correct when he says the most common symptom of COVID-19 is that you feel fine. Most of the people who have apparently got this disease have absolutely no symptoms at all.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of things we don't understand about this disease, about how far it's spread through the community, about what the death rate is compared to infection rates. And basically, some countries have taken a safety first policy, like New Zealand, like Scotland. Other countries like England, where Peter Hitchens' party, the Conservative Party, runs the country, have taken a more laissez-faire
attitude.
Well,
he's one of their biggest critics.
Well, he is and he isn't, Tony. I'm not going to argue about what his politics are. I mean, on some things like Syria, I agree with him, but a stop clock is right twice a day. The fact is, there's going to be an objective test of all of this, because we've got different policies being pursued in different countries, and we're going to see different outcomes. And then there's going to be an inquiry in Britain into what went wrong here, because some things clearly did go wrong, like they didn't lock down quick enough, and that there's possibly tens of thousands of people who would be alive if they had. And there's going to be an inquiry like the Iraq War inquiry. And, of course, lots of Tories. I mean, if you read Andrew Rawnsley in The Observer this week, he's saying Boris Johnson is now getting very, very frightened of a second spike in England because it could well have his head on it.
The idea of tens of thousands of people dying, that may also have been prevented with the use of chloroquine. It might also have been prevented if the government had advised people to be getting people to take zinc, vitamin D and vitamin C in order to boost their immune system. But one of the main things you talk about, Martin, is you don't think that there will be a vaccine. The fact is that there are quite a lot under preparation, and some of them are rather sinister. I talked to Dr. Judith Brown this week about the DNA altering vaccines which are under preparation.
Ordinary people feel very concerned about the vaccine. First of all, of course, it changes your DNA, and that's going to be a permanent change.
But surely most vaccines don't do that, do they?
No, this is the first one. They actually inject an RNA, and in addition to the RNA strand, they have a substance that they call M that they We don't know what that is, that they attach to the RNA strand, and that's the basis of the vaccine. But we don't actually know what M is, and presumably it's M that attaches to your DNA.
Okay, that's well, can you just explain in what way that vaccine is different to, say, some ordinary vaccine like the old measles vaccine used to be?
Well, what you normally get is maybe a dead virus or an altered virus that's injected into your body, and that causes you to have an antibody response to that particular substance. But the difference in this is that it actually genetically modifies the human body so that the human body then has an ability to manufacture antibodies if it comes across the coronavirus in the future.
So is that your blood or chromosomes get changed, your whole body?
Your whole body, yeah, which is quite amazing.
So it goes through every cell and changes the chromosome?
Every cell. The whole body will be genetically modified.
So how does that help?
Well, they say that it'll stop people from getting coronaviruses, but and then they say that you might even need a booster. Of course, they're also talking about it being injected with a completely different form of injection that we haven't seen before. That's instead of having one needle, it's got sort of like a little pad of tiny needles, and included in that is a sort of like a tattoo, which isn't visible to the naked eye. But there are certain apps that you can have on your phone that actually they can shine on your arm to see whether you've had the vaccination or not. I think the other things that people are worried about in terms of the vaccine, the fact that it's a DNA vaccine, so therefore it has to be manufactured from somewhere, from human cells. And they're using human embryonic cells in order to manufacture it, because that it isn't the first vaccine where they've actually used embryonic cells, but they are using them in a completely different way. Some people are very worried about that, especially people who've got a particular religious position.
We're talking about a society being separated into two classes of people, those who've had the vaccine and those who have decided not to.
Yeah. Yes, I think personally that the vaccine isn't going to be mandated, but there's going to be so much coercion. For example, they're going to say that you can't travel on aeroplanes unless they can prove that you've had the vaccine. You can't maybe go into shops, virtually restricting people to house arrest if they don't have a vaccine. And I think that unless there is a massive protest against that, I think that that it's going to be very difficult to resist.
So that's Dr. Judith Brown. She's not a medical doctor, but she did work for many years as a nurse. And she then went out to work over in Yemen for the United Nations. Martin, that is just one of these new types of vaccines that they're talking about here, one that alters your DNA, hopefully enabling your cells to better fight the virus, the coronavirus, which, of course, you know, it's worth mentioning, these coronaviruses have been around time immemorial. From the common cold types, but the medical profession still never found any kind of vaccine to the coronavirus. Generally, would you trust the government if the various regulators say that this virus is safe if it does appear on the scene?
You mean vaccine, not virus?
Yeah.
Well, the question is, with all of these things, is who guards the guardians? Basically, as we know, Big Pharma in the West is driven by profit and massive profit at the same at that, all based around intellectual property rights for research that they've conducted, often with funding from governments. I mean, governments have been chucking loads of money at this problem, as you can imagine, but they've given it in the West to private sector companies who will then own the vaccines that they create. And of course, the whole setup is completely open to corruption of all kinds. And it's quite possible that they do want to have everybody chipped with these vaccines, even if there's nothing in the vaccine, because you've then created a kind of chip society that you can manipulate. But of course, at the same time as we're saying this, both the Cubans and the Chinese and others, the communists, if you like, are trying to develop a vaccine which they say they will give away if they develop one, and they won't have any, you know, and there won't be any material interest involved in it at all. Now, ultimately, as a socialist, I would say that we've got to regulate all of these things and the regulators have got to have teeth, and they've got to be able to, and in actual fact, the case for nationalization, in other words, socialization of the creation of medicine, is overwhelming. What real interest does the private sector have in running this? Something like an epidemic like this just brings home how interdependent human society is. There's no way that we can all operate independently in face of these kind of threats. And therefore, we need collective health provision. And the countries that have done well in so far in this crisis have, in fact, been those with a socialist system, including Kerala in southern India, which has been run by the Communist Party of India since the 40s. And of course, they've got low level medical personnel operating in all of their rural communities. And the same true in Cuba. Venezuela has done very well. So has Nicaragua. The places have done very badly are places like South Africa, where although you've got a left-wing government, they haven't got much power. And, of course, in Brazil, where Bolsonaro still denies that there's anything going on as the bodies pile up.
Including Sweden, which didn't lock down at all.
Well, as I said earlier, Tony, we're going to get a very good experiment here. Lots of different countries have adopted different policies, and we're going to be able to look through all of it and see who's done well and who's done badly. The countries that have done very well.
Will you be taking this virus when it comes along? This virus?
You mean vaccine? It depends on what it is and who's offering it. I still have my doubts whether you can get a vaccine for a common cold. We've not, as you said earlier, they've been looking for a vaccine for the common cold for decades, and they haven't found it. We haven't found a vaccine for HIV.
Okay, well, either. let's go now and have a look at censorship around this whole issue. And we heard last week from Robin Campbell, who's an IT consultant here in Bristol, and I went to see him this week where he told me about the censorship of his YouTube channel after he put up an interview with a medical doctor, Dr. Mohammed Adil, who was subsequently struck off. Well, in fact, he was struck off for literally criticizing government policy on the virus. Now, this is a particularly horrific thing, I think, to happen, because we need our doctors to be able to feel free to speak their mind about this, because, as we know, we need to have a second opinion for our own situations with medical issues. And of course, that needs to happen too. With the pandemic, and the idea that you're intimidating doctors to take the government line is particularly frightening. So let's have a listen now to Robin Campbell talking about what happened to his YouTube channel.
I'd either just upload a great interview with a doctor, or I would go off and check out, do some research myself. For instance, I did one on the VSTS Enterprises from Manchester, who seemed to get the gig for contact tracing. I went onto the company's house, looked at their history, and put together a small 10-minute video on who are these people, why are they getting the gig. They seem to have their software ready in March, got awarded, I think it was 28 million quid's worth of contract back in the end of March or early April, when contract tracing was hardly in anyone's mind. That seemed preemptive to me and worthy of exposing. So I did some of my own videos. I uploaded some. I was doing interviews with people, and someone recommended I talk to Dr. Adil from Oldham, who's 35 years in the business, and he was a cancer surgeon, and I was recommended I talk to him. And at this stage, I'd learned how to live stream, do all the bits and bobs online, and he agreed to come on. We did a 2-hour interview where he shared all of the science, all of the principles of treating viruses. He went through all of his concerns, particularly in the world of cancer treatment and lots of patients missing their treatments. He also went into disparaging strategy on care homes worldwide, not just in the UK, where the infected were being thrown straight into care homes, essentially throwing a hand grenade into that care home. And also his concern about big business and the Gates Foundation, WHO directives, CDC corruption, the vaccine industry being completely dominant in all policy, it seemed. And also just human freedoms and civil liberties. The doctor's a very moral person. He runs a charity and institution like a university in Pakistan, which is a bit like a feeder university into the UK. So he spreads health and wealth. That's a very honourable thing to be doing. Very highly esteemed where he worked and amongst that community. And when the video was published and released, it took 48 hours for YouTube to terminate my channel. Now, for those that have a channel, you'll know that normally you get a deletion warning or you get a strike. And typically up to perhaps January this year, you would have had 3 strikes and you're out rule. Well, that didn't apply to my channel. I didn't have any strikes. I had some videos deleted for community guidelines because they went against the mainstream narrative. And I had no recourse, no right to do anything about my channel. It just went. So I didn't stop, though. I just got going again. And then I interviewed Dr. Adil's friend as well.
How many videos did you have on the channel when it was deleted?
I had 313, 80 gigabytes worth of hard work.
And how many hits had the Dr. Adil interview had?
It's hard to say. I think it was pushing up over 40-odd thousand.
So that's the discussion with Robin Campbell, Martin, about this sort of form of censorship is where we seem to be edging towards the China levels of censorship, where one thought that there was an ability and an interest in what doctors were saying about this, but apparently not. And in fact, I remember right at the very beginning being told by NHS staff that they were being effectively threatened. Do not speak to the press at all about anything to do with the pandemic or anything to do with your job. Otherwise, you will never work again.
Yeah, well, it's on the face of it, a quite disturbing story. I think the YouTube channel stuff, I mean, basically, YouTube is a private organisation and they can do anything they like.
Well, one
and
of the most.
It is censorship, but it's like
one of the most.
They don't want to put your stuff up there. There's not a lot you can do about it. You can try and find another mechanism for circulating your videos. The striking off of a doctor for speaking out, that disturbed me more. And I'd like to know what the justification for that was, because it sounds to me as if that's completely disproportionate.
But it's two aspects, isn't it, Martin? It's two aspects to demonizing somebody for their views. Number one, stopping their professional career, and number two, gagging them, making it impossible for people at the moment to hear what he's got to say.
Yeah, well, as you know, Tony, YouTube have got plenty of techniques for silencing things they don't like. The same is true of Twitter, any of these platforms. Don't forget, they are money-making exercises, and they're embedded with the deep state, and they're embedded with the pharmaceutical
company.
Well,
certainly Google is, isn't it? And we know that they're very, very close ties between the parent company of YouTube, Google, and the National Security Agency, for example. But anyway, let's listen to a second clip with Robin, because I thought it'd be interesting to ask him. I mean, he has lots to say about how almost all the media now is becoming incredibly toxic here in the West. You know, really coming up alongside the sort of thing we've seen in China, the mass censorship in China. So the idea that the West is a bastion of free speech is being thrown down the toilet. And also asked him about what he thinks that, if there's any kind of exit strategy for this situation that we're in now.
I've been chatting about this with my wife, the fact that the mainstream media is so toxic at the moment. You either become a slave because you've watched too much of it, or you turn it off and go and find something more reliable. Equally, I find it staggering that there's been no sessions in Parliament. Where is the Labour Party challenging what's being done? Why isn't there any pushback right now to what Boris and the Tories are up to? Where's the Labour Party? Where are they?
Well, it's because there's a pandemic going on. This might happen afterwards.
This totalitarian creep is marching on at a pace. And if we don't push back and if we don't shine the light on this pervasive control of the narrative, then we are at risk. So I think we're at risk of losing those liberties.
So why do you say totalitarian? I mean, surely the situation is we're in a pandemic. The government has got to enforce lockdown or measures to stop it.
Yeah, and I thought that for the first 2 weeks in March. But then when it was 2 weeks had gone. We're now into protecting the NHS. We built the Nightingale hospitals. We got into April. That seemed to be achieved. No cases in Bristol. You know, hospitals empty. Waiting lists down at 13 in Bath, for instance. Nightingale hospitals empty. Doctors and nurses being laid off. I thought that's time to release this lockdown and get on with business. But oh no, the lockstep document written by the Rockefeller Foundation itemizes this strategy worldwide, as if you go on the World Economic Forum, you'll see this huge mind map, which is up there ready with COVID-19 marked on it early March. And people pointed this out. It seemed to be a completely done deal with very, very nuanced and layered strategies going into all aspects of our lives. So if you had the, if you had that awareness back in March, you could see it was coming. But it's like talking to people around you is quite a challenge because they don't have that 360 view on things, nor do they have this, this inbuilt innate mistrust of what's coming out of their goggle box. And they don't realize there's a lot of propaganda going on and brainwashing.
So look, you're painting a picture of masses of humanity being herded around like animals. What's the actual, do you have an exit strategy from this?
I can tell you, I belong to a very thriving community and there's lots of people wanting to just get out, you know, off-grid communities. I'm actually helping an off-grid community in Bristol called Eco Villages, which aims to get off-grid completely. And I think that's a viable option now, just to get out from any of this city-dwelling, Agenda 21-type, high-density city life.
That's Robin Campbell again there. Martin, there is it's quite obvious that for many people, they're just simply trusting. I mean, you said a few weeks ago, you know, the BBC have come out very well out of this. There's another point of view, which is that people are switching off their TVs. People are switching off from the mass media. They simply don't trust what they're being told, particularly with the pandemic over, actually cases that basically down to zero of people who are seriously ill or dying in many parts of the country. And yet the methods of control seem to be ramping up.
All right. Well, I'm not necessarily going to agree with you that we're down to zero. And don't forget the obvious argument from the establishment point of view.
Well, OK, can I just say one thing, Martin, about this zero? Is there have been no fatalities for COVID-19 in Scotland for nearly a month now?
Yes, and that's the way they want to keep it, Tony.
And yet, what they're trying to do is lock down cities like Aberdeen.
Well, that's a decision for the Scottish government. You'll have to take it up with them. Can I just mention, if we're talking about conspiracies, the Times of Israel said that the US Defense Intelligence Agency told them in November that there was going to be a pandemic coming out of China. Now, in other words, somebody, not in March, in November, knew there was a pandemic coming out of China. And I'm quite sure that the Chinese intelligence services and the Russian intelligence services, we had that guy from the GRU on some weeks ago saying, well, we think this is a biological warfare attack on China. Now, if it's a biological warfare attack, it's not just made up, is it?
No, it certainly isn't. No one's saying that. But what I am saying most clearly here is that there is a absurd situation where many of the methods of dealing with this situation are increasing just as the cases are falling down to zero in Scotland.
Well, as I say, you'll have to take that up with the Scottish government.
All right, Martin.
Don't forget they are elected.
That reply
and in actual fact, anyhow, if you look at the opinion polls, Tony, you will see that the Scottish population are far happier with Nicola Sturgeon than the English population
Let's see. I don't believe those. I think we'll see if there's an election.
You know, believe them or not, but there they are.
Yeah. Let's see if there's an election, how well Nicola Sturgeon does.
There's an election coming up next May.
I mean,
they're looking as if they're going to win. I don't think anybody assumes anything else. They're definitely going to win.
She's obviously been intimately involved in this prosecution of Alex Salmond and the subsequent prosecution of Craig Murray, having centralised all police power into one person's hands in the whole of Scotland from all the individual forces. But let's have a listen now to Dr. Mohammed Adil. This is the guy that's been struck off, who I spoke to earlier this week, because one of the most important things at the moment are these tests, because the tests are now causing, even if you don't have any symptoms, and some individual specific places are being tested through contact tracing. People are being told to come and get tested, or they're even having tests sent to them and being sent back. And so what we're doing is we're closing down cities and towns and regions based on the results of these tests, based on the Serco, unreliable Serco's contact tracing system. But how reliable are the tests themselves? I thought I'd ask Dr. Mohammed Adil, who's been struck off, that question.
The tests are not reliable at all. I don't know. The various tests are coming up into the test and tracing and all sort of fancy things are going on. And there's a commercial advertisement on the BBC sort of TV, which is international fame, with a different instrument they are showing to the public that this is an instrument which can test 15,000 patients in an hour. This is what okay. For example, if this is a test kit, what is going to mean by somebody who is a normal person like myself or yourself and all the children, if they got test positive, what does it mean? Do they need an isolation? The answer is no. Do they need to stop work? The answer is no. Do they need to not to see their parents or the grandparents? The answer is they should see them. There is no indication anybody being test positive should be isolated and be locked down into the home or into the cage. That is not an indication. That is causing serious problems.
So they could pass the disease on to someone else.
No, this is the fear they have generated, actually. That, you know, I go to the shopping center, I go to the shops, and I'm surprised to see the people, they're wearing masks. 80% people are wearing masks in the shopping center without having any clue that what the mask is going to damage to their body internally. They've got a mask on their face, they're not able to even breathe, and they are recirculating, rebreathing their carbon dioxide. And they're not having fresh air at all, and that is causing more damage.
So that's Dr. Mohammed Adil there. Martin's saying two things. This is the what you get struck off for nowadays is a second opinion. Saying two things. First of all, he doesn't believe that the masks are effective, that actually what you're doing is you're re-inhaling the same air again and again, which can be a problem, can allow actually viruses to build up in there. And also saying that the tests are simply not reliable enough.
Well, I mean, the question of whether the tests are reliable enough or not, that's a definite question. Because obviously, if you're using duff tests, then you're not going to get the results you want. But I have to say that in the countries which have had a good COVID war, the ones I was mentioning earlier, including the People's Republic of China, they isolated everybody who tested positive. They didn't just say go home. They provided them with premises for which to go and self-isolate, and they paid their wages and stuff like that. So they took it. That's what they did at the very beginning of the crisis. And of course, as I stressed earlier, the Times of Israel said that the Defense Intelligence Agency of the United States tipped off the Israeli Defense Forces that something like this was coming in November. But of course, the Chinese got on the program. The Kerelans got on the program. The New Zealanders got on the program, and they've managed to largely evade this virus. Whereas, of course, in the US and Britain, it's run amok. And of course, it has to run amok in the US because the financial system started collapsing in September, as we heard the other week from our Croatian friend. And of course, at that point, they need to have a distraction from the collapse of the financial system. And seeding a biological weapon in China fits the bill.
What about all those people that have not been treated because of this? Now, we're hearing this as a statistic I mentioned last week, which is though 45,000 people or so have had COVID-19 on their death certificate. So, in other words, they died with COVID-19, not of COVID-19, the total for the lockdown is looking like something like 200,000. That is to say, for example, cancer patients and other patients that simply weren't treated and so died prematurely.
Yeah, well, I'm not saying I've got all the answers to any of this. We're all struggling in the dark. But the counter argument would be, if you don't lock down, then you're going to have more deaths from COVID-19. If you do lock down, you have more deaths from other stuff. And of course, if you get it right, you minimise deaths from both, which is exactly what's happening in New Zealand and Kerala.
Martin, how does the shutting down of the National Health Service's normal activities fit in with all this?
Well, that's an issue in countries that have a health service. But don't forget, lots of countries like the United States of America say you're going to cut down the health service.
You know
most people haven't got any health. They say you should talk to your ordinary doctor.
Martin, you know what I'm talking about.
Got a doctor.
I'm not talking about countries with no health service. I'm talking about the UK.
Yeah, well, but there's going to be an inquiry into all of this, Tony, and whether they did the right things at the right time. But in New Zealand, where they locked down early, they're out of lockdown now. We're not out of lockdown because we missed up when
okay,
the bus was
finally,
going
right. Finally, let's just look at the – there's this – I mean, something I think sounded to me totally absurd, which is the discussion that apparently you may be able to open pubs or schools, but not both. You've got to decide, you know. So if you open the pubs up, the schools have got to close. If you open the schools up, the pubs have got to close. Now, this just seems absurd to me when you've got death rates banging around zero. And we've never in the world's history ever had quarantining and restrictions for people who are not actually showing any symptoms or in any way ill. You've never had people who have been not ill.
Quarantine was in Venice originally. They invented it. Any ship coming into Venice, the people had to wait on an island outside Venice for 40 days, whether they'd shown any symptoms or not. That's because they were worried about plague.
And what was that, year after year. Was that in medieval times?
Yes.
Okay, so maybe it's never been done for hundreds of years. And, of course, Venice was a totalitarian city-state.
No, it was an oligarchy like the modern oligarchies. I mean, if you're going to talk historical facts, Tony, you've got to get the historical facts right rather than just painting.
I mean, I have actually got that historical fact right.
Quarantine was for everybody coming in, whether they showed any symptoms. There's an island where they used to put them.
Martin, you just said that. You know, actually, what we're saying here is, in fact, you've made your argument for me, is that it's only in a totalitarian oligarchic state that this kind of thing could happen.
These are public health measures which were adopted because they didn't really understand disease. They took a precautionary approach. That's pretty much what most sensible governments have done in relation to this. And, of course, the IDF, as I said earlier, were warned in November that it was coming. And, of course, there'll be questions in Israel. Why didn't we do anything about it since we've been told in November that this was coming? And, of course, the question is, how did the Defence Intelligence Agency of the United States know that something was coming in November? That's a question, isn't it?
Okay, the National NHS figures, we're now looking at something like 5 people a day dying with COVID-19, not of COVID-19. So, I mean, I'm surprised that we've got any kind of measures whatsoever because this seems a very extreme measure. Now it seems like we've pretty much achieved herd immunity here in Britain and that young people are not going to be circulating this disease simply because they've already had it and a very mild sense.
What's going to happen now is going to be interesting, isn't it? Different countries are pursuing different strategies in relation to releasing lockdown. But I think it's pretty clear, even in the countries that have done well, like Germany, that when you release the lockdown, the damn thing comes back, which is what you'd expect, isn't it? Just logically.
Yeah, Neil Ferguson, I thought we'd seen the last of him. He was the guy that is funded by the Gates Foundation, who was responsible for triggering the lockdown by basically scaring the government into thinking there was going to be 500,000 people die of COVID-19, not with COVID-19. As it actually turned out, the total number of people who died of COVID-19 and nothing else is around about 1,300. So he was about 500 or 400 or so times out on that. He's been saying this week, finally, Martin, that the R number may rise if secondary schools reopen.
Well, it's pretty likely that it will. I mean, you're arguing what are essentially counterintuitively. Most people realise that we don't really know what this virus is. We've got people like us talk about the conspiracies of biological warfare. Most people don't go into it in that sort of detail. They just take what the government says and says, OK, this is potentially dangerous. We're going to listen to what they're saying. Now, you've got to have a very good reason to say that's all nonsense.
Well, I'll tell you why. Martin, you just asked for a good reason. I'll tell you the good reason. And that is to say that we're now talking about cases, most of which, in fact, almost all of which are asymptomatic rather than anybody actually even getting ill.
But the point about the asymptomatic cases, this is, didn't you see Boris Johnson saying we didn't know about asymptomatic cases when we put all of these people from the hospitals into the care homes? They weren't showing any symptoms, so we just presumed they were all right. They should have been tested, and what the tests would have shown that they weren't all right. And that's the whole point about this disease. There's some incubation period. We're not quite sure what it is. Well, you don't show any symptoms. Well, some people are infectious, but don't show any symptoms.
Just a minute.
It's like Typhoid Mary, who killed loads of people in New York back in the 19th century.
You're just factually inaccurate there, because right at the start, it was realised from China that there was the Chinese told the world that there's a 2-week incubation period. So the idea.
Yes, but Boris Johnson tried to get out of responsibility for moving people from the hospitals.
Because
he said, oh, we didn't know. They did know, as you've just pointed out.
Well, at least we agree on that. Anyway, we'll be talking about Beirut after some music.
This is Layabout. Well, I'm a layabout, a full-time layabout. I want to be a layabout, a genuine 24-carat layabout. And if I want to be a layabout, I'm going to be a layabout. A 24-hour day layabout. About. Well, what's the point in going out? Cause I'm a genuine 24-carat layabout. And if I wanna be a layabout, what's wrong with being a layabout? The rats,
from 1995, the Nubiles and Layabout. That's the John Peel session version of that song. Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling, renamed as Not the BCFM Politics Show. Now, this week, censorship is definitely the theme again, actually, for as last week. But we'll be starting with the bomb in Beirut Harbour, or the accident, and discussing the enormous blast which destroyed Lebanon's ability to trade. And what if we've been lied to about the dangers of radiation, of nuclear power stations, of Fukushima? ever since the models still used today, which were created around the time of the 75th anniversary this week of the Hiroshima explosion, the first atomic bomb dropped by the United States on Japan. We talked to Chris Busby about what he believed is the failed and flawed model for measuring the dangers of nuclear power plants today, including our very own Hinkley C. And by the way, Chris thinks that'll probably never be built. Also, more on the mass media, what they are not telling us about the extraordinary release of the Ghislaine Maxwell court papers. John Paul Rice, he's a Hollywood film producer, he says, never mind the Me Too movement, he believes that there is an evil paedophile ring in Hollywood. What about the kids, he says, and he's even done a film called A Child's Voice about it, which has been censored this week by Amazon. Censorship always seems to be the main thing we talk about on this program these days, which has itself been censored. And Bulgarian investigative journalist Diliana Gaitacheva, she speaks in an exclusive interview to me this week about her discovery of the arms pipeline to the so-called Syrian rebels mainly via Turkey. Anyway, Martin, let's start with this attack over in Beirut. What's your assessment of what went on there?
Well, obviously, the mainstream media are seeing this as a terrible accident, and they're also claiming that it shows that Lebanon's rulers are incompetent. I see that Rafik Hariri's son has said we all know the underlying problem here is Hezbollah and their international connections and so on. So as usual with an incident like this, that's the official level. Then you go dig down a level deeper, and various people like Richard Silverstein, Thierry Masson, other people of some repute are saying, no, what this is an Israeli attack on a Hezbollah arms warehouse, which has gone wrong because it's exploded this other warehouse next door, which has got all this stuff in it, the ammonium nitrate, which exploded. And also there are videos circulating on the internet, which I've seen today, which seem to show a missile hitting just before the second explosion. Now, of course, this is all within a context in which Israel is ramping up a war on Iran, which requires it to destabilize Lebanon and defang Hezbollah. So we've got means, motive and opportunity all there. Incidentally, the Israelis have offered to help the Lebanese with this, which is extraordinary because they're enemy countries and they've never helped any Arab country with anything apart from supplying arms and providing medical care to ISIS people.
Anyway,
Martin,
one of the most interesting statements was made by Donald Trump himself.
Yes, Trump, of course, I've forgotten to mention.
Saying that this looks like a bomb, and he called it an attack. So let's have a listen to Donald Trump now.
Let me begin by sending America's deepest sympathies to the people of Lebanon, where reports indicate that many, many people were killed. Hundreds more were very badly wounded in a large explosion in Beirut. Our prayers go out to all the victims and their families. The United States stands ready to assist Lebanon. We have a very good relationship with the people of Lebanon, and we will be there to help. It looks like a terrible attack.
Are you confident that this was an attack and not an accident?
Well, it would seem like it based on the explosion. I've met with some of our great generals, and they just seemed to feel that this was not some kind of a manufacturing explosion type of event. This was seems to be, according to them, they would know better than I would, but they seemed to think it was a attack. It was a bomb of some kind, yes.
Well, that's pretty clear from Trump.
He's rowed back on that since.
Well, yeah, but there's a lot of rowing back going on. There was that in itself is an indication that there's news management going on. If the basic statements are then rowed back on, if someone is telling you, no, you shouldn't have said that kind of thing. We also heard a little bit, didn't we, at the beginning about this having a mushroom cloud looking like a mini nuke, but I've seen a pretty comprehensive, certainly it didn't look like that to me, and pretty comprehensive explanation saying, well, if it's a nuclear weapon, it's going to have a fireball. This thing didn't have a fireball. But most interestingly, for me, Martin, is the, you know, what you were saying is the context of all of this, because what this bomb on Tuesday evening has done is it's actually completely crippled Lebanon's ability to trade. But amazingly, the mainstream media's narrative right across the West now is blaming Lebanon itself and Lebanon's government. And we've even had President Macron going over there. I mean, who knows? Maybe he's threatening them and he's having secret talks about something that they're planning, more that they're planning to do, and that they better give in right now. Saying that this is the very, very clearly laying the blame at the foot of the Lebanese government for destroying their own port.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at all the things that are being said, it makes me extremely suspicious about this event. Hezbollah had a guy, one of their people was killed in Syria last week, and they generally retaliate for those killings, but they don't immediately retaliate. There's some story last week about there was some infiltration by the Shabar farms and the Israelis killed some people, but then both the Israelis and Hezbollah denied it. Everything is on edge. And basically, it's part of the Israeli strategy to destabilize Lebanon, to make sure that Hezbollah is removed from the government of Lebanon. And don't forget, the Israelis intervened massively in the Lebanese civil war to support their proteges.
Well, look,
and
I mean,
they still regard it as their backyard.
Even closer to, I mean, we didn't report it last Friday, but it Friday morning was reported in the Israeli press that Benny Gantz had instructed the Israeli Defense Force to bomb Lebanese infrastructure if Hezbollah was to harm any of their soldiers. Defense Minister Benny Gantz last week instructed the IDF to bomb Lebanese infrastructure if Hezbollah has harmed any IDF soldiers or Israeli civilians. A senior defense official told Israeli Hayom that Gantz issued the order to prepare such a response during the meetings on Thursday with the IDF chief of staff, Aviv Kochavi, and other members of the general staff. So, I mean, it does seem as if there was any kind of incidents over the weekend, and whether there were or not, the Israeli military was certainly considering bombing infrastructure in Lebanon, and this is possibly the most important piece of infrastructure in the entire country.
Yes, that's right. And, of course, everything is on edge here now. I mean, everybody's waiting. And don't forget, with the election coming up in November in the US and the possibility that Trump may no longer be there, the war faction in Israel are quite keen to get a war with Iran started with the Americans involved, and presumably the British, since we always do as we're told. Most people in Britain probably not paying too much attention to all of this, but we will be dragged in for sure. And that's what possibly this is what Richard Silverstein was suggesting, who is, you know, a pretty good anti-Zionist Jewish activist. He's basically saying that this was a botched attempt to take out a Hezbollah arms dump, but it actually blew up the ammonium nitrate warehouse next door. It wasn't intended to kill as many people as this, but they've messed it up. And that's what's going on here. Neither the Israeli government doesn't want to admit that's what happened, and Hezbollah don't want to admit what's happened, because it then puts them in the firing line. Why are you storing weapons in this warehouse, etc.? But of course, as I said earlier, there are also videos circulating on the internet. They've been taken down, but I've managed to see them this afternoon. They're out there showing a missile hitting the building just before the
second. That certainly is possible, but it's also possible those videos have been...
Exactly. I'm not saying anything, but people can, if you look out there, you'll see that that's out there and people are commenting on it.
Have been photoshopped or whatever. But look, I'm going to post a link up on our show page to a fascinating piece of film. And this is it's called A Mysterious Explosion. Looks to me like a kind of advanced fuel air bomb. Now, I'm sure, Martin, you'll be familiar with these weapons. It's called the thermobaric weapon. What happens basically is that there's two explosions very rapidly, one after the other. The first one injects a massive amount of high explosive into the atmosphere in a aerosol form, and then the second explosion will then set light to that, and it causes a massive explosion, and it evacuates all the air, and anyone within that area will be suffocated and killed by this. But it has exactly the same kind of, should we say, dome cloud-like shape, also with a kind of pillar in the middle of it of thick, dense smoke. as the one that we saw in, I mean, so I would just suggest that people have a look at our show page later at thisweek.org.uk at this mysterious explosion, the film of that taken in Syria 7 months ago, and compare it to what happened in Beirut, because it looks to me as if it's exactly the same weapon that was used. And of course, if you set fire to ammonium nitrate, as I don't know if you ever tried this, Martin, but it doesn't explode in a bomb-like way. It certainly explodes, but it's a very slow burn explosion as the fire rips through the chemical. It certainly doesn't explode in the same way as a bomb does, and a bomb is, with those chemicals in the high explosive, sealed in a metal container, a metal tube, or a bomb will go off in a completely different way, very much more like this one we saw in Syria. So I would suggest that this is almost certainly, and looking at the circumstantial evidence of the news management as well, a bomb attack. Now, let's just look at the implications of that, because does that mean that the Israelis, without telling the Americans, have destroyed this important part of Lebanon in a way that they may have liked to have done years ago, but they couldn't get away with because militarily they couldn't do it, but they can do a sneak attack and use the mass media of the Western world in order to try and convince everybody that it's nothing to do with Israel. It's all the Lebanese government's own fault.
Yeah, that sounds perfectly plausible to me. And don't forget, this afternoon, the Israeli Defense Forces, their air force, has attacked Syrian army positions. They've not been doing that up to now. They've been attacking Hezbollah. They've been attacking Iranian positions inside Syria, but they haven't directly attacked Syrian army positions. But apparently they've done that this afternoon. And that's because the right wing in Israel, who are also facing corruption charges, all sorts of things, they are basically pushing for a war with Iran before November, and that something like this would help them to do that. It helps to destabilize Lebanon, which is clearly the strategy, that the economy in Lebanon has been attacked, basically, because unless Hezbollah leaves the government, Lebanon is persona non grata in the West. Now, Lebanon have been embedded in the coalition government in Lebanon for some years now. They're in alliance with Michel Aoun and some elements within the Christian community. The opposition in Syria, in Lebanon, is largely made up of the Sunnis and some of the other Christians. Rafik Hariri started to bloviate about how it's Hezbollah's fault that this has happened. And of course, his father was assassinated, supposedly by Hezbollah, but it was actually the Israelis, as Hezbollah proved in a press conference where they showed the video footage from the Israeli drone, which had actually fired the missile which killed Hariri, because they'd hacked into it. Now, I think it's quite likely that the Israelis either didn't expect the level of casualties, I don't know. But in any case, we know that they're trying to destabilize Lebanon at the moment, as are the US deep state. So it's very suspicious that something like this
should happen.
They're
not just destabilizing it by stopping their ability to trade with the outside world, Martin. They've crippled Lebanon.
Well, that's right. And the demand is Hezbollah must leave the government. We need a new government in Lebanon which is friendly to Israel. And everybody else in Israel is going to have their feet held to the fire until Hezbollah is removed. Now, Hezbollah, in fact, are the only properly armed faction in Lebanon. And they're regarded as a patriotic faction, even by Christians, because most of the Shia communities concentrated in the south of Lebanon, south of Beirut and southwards towards the border with Israel. And they've taken the brunt of fighting with Israel. And since 2006, they've established what they call the terms of engagement with Israel, which is Israel is basically in 2006, Hezbollah defeated the Israeli army. And they're actually, because of all the fighting they've been doing in Syria, where they've lost thousands of people, they've become much, much more efficient and well organized than they were even previously. And of course, Hezbollah has got battalions of troops who are Christians, who have Christian pastors, but they're integrated into Hezbollah's military structure. And anybody who knows anything about armies knows that Hezbollah is one of the best organized, best trained, basically probably the top outfit on the planet. That's why they were able to defeat the Israeli Defense Force.
I mean, people might say, why would Benjamin Netanyahu and Benny Gantz do something like this? Well, the answer could well be that they've had a series of weekly demonstrations which have been rocking Israel for months, virtually unreported here in the UK, drawing a growing number of people angry with the government's handling of a second wave of COVID-19 infections and the economic impacts of the pandemic. Political dissatisfaction is at the heart of these protests, according to Deutsche Welle. To put it in two words, the main goal is get out Bibi. Bibi resign, says 59-year-old Tali Etzion from Tel Aviv. So, he's been hanging on by his fingernails, hasn't he, Netanyahu, to power? And it looks as if you've got regular weekly protests on the Sabbath day on the streets of Israel, with tens of thousands of people protesting against Netanyahu. And it is possibly feasible that he may wish to actually start a war to get himself out of this bind.
Yeah, I mean, you've got a number of factors. He's got a personal interest in distraction from his own personal problems. But there's a long-running desire on the part of the deep state in Israel to annex the West Bank, to annex the Golan Heights, to annex Lebanon up to the Litani River so they can get the water resources. And they've been destabilizing other countries around them all along. That's part of the Yinon plan going back to the 1980s to balkanize states adjacent to Israel and so on. I mean, they basically are belligerent. And they've got the biggest army in the Middle East. They've got hundreds of nuclear weapons. But they still couldn't beat Hezbollah in 2006. Their tanks were wiped out by people coming forward with anti-tank weaponry. And Hezbollah have now got thousands of missiles. And if there is a war with Lebanon, then basically the infrastructure of Israel is going to be blown to bits. And, of course, their response to that, to blow up the infrastructure of Lebanon, that won't stop Hezbollah doing what they're going to do. But Hezbollah don't want to fight, nor does the Syrian army, nor does the Russian army, nor does the Iranian army, nor does the Chinese army. But ultimately, this is what's going to happen if the fools in charge continue on their reckless course.
I mean, let's go back to this idea that the Lebanese government are responsible for their own problems. I mean, I don't think that anybody with more than one or half a brain cell would say that, because actually what's going on is there's been an international economic warfare against that country, really, by the likes of the IMF and the Western financial bankster powers.
Well, that's right. And up to now, Lebanon has been, in a way, because it was so volatile, outside powers have tried to prop up the rather rickety political structure inside Lebanon. Because, you know, Lebanon was in a civil war in the 1970s, in which, as I said earlier, the Israelis had a very big hand. And Macron, of course, you've got to remember that France used to be the colonial power, and they were only kicked out of Syria after a massive uprising.
Well, now again this week, apparently they're back. Well, just one final thing on this horrific bomb attack. We reckon
that's what it is.
Well, I mean, I think I don't think there's much doubt about it. You know, the idea, if you look at the difference between if you set fire to a warehouse full or bags or stacks of ammonium nitrate, it just simply doesn't go bang in the same way as that bomb appeared to go bang. And I would agree with the US military in this case, probably, you know, the Israelis didn't decide, they didn't really particularly want to tell the Americans that they were going to do something like that, or whoever has done this.
Well, that's right, because they've got an interest in dragging the US into a war in the Middle East. So they do stuff to get things going so that the Americans will be dragged in. And they don't necessarily tell the Americans that they're going to do these things.
But the interesting side is that another thing is that there was lots and lots of film of it. And the reason there was lots of film of it is because there was a fire close to the place of the impact of the bomb, or whatever this was. And so that obviously meant that people would be filming the fire. So this reminds me a little bit of the Twin Towers, Martin, where, you know, you've got to have two aircraft hit two towers. Otherwise, no one is filming when the second one goes in to make sure that there is actually film of this bomb going off. That's where this fire comes in. So that could possibly have been a deliberately set fire in order to make sure that there was a lot of attention on the bomb when it actually went off.
It's possible. And of course, with the plausible deniability, Israel said nothing to do with us, nothing to do with us. But as Hezbollah proved, to my satisfaction, they were the ones who assassinated Rafiq Hariri Sr. And that, of course, was determined to try and destabilize Lebanon. And we know, going back to the 1960s, 70s, that the Israelis were bombing Lebanon with car bombs and all sorts in order to provoke civil war in Lebanon, because it suited their book for there to be a civil war in Lebanon. That's their track record. So that's the history.
Okay,
so
now also...
The people in Lebanon, especially from the Hezbollah side, will be very much thinking, well, this is probably the Israelis.
I mean, this also, it? Martin, comes against a backdrop, not only of the horrific attacks, economic warfare there's been on Lebanon, but also the fires at key sites in Iran that have been taking place over the last few months. Yep. So these fires also haven't really been reported. The Iranians have been playing them down to a certain extent, but we've seen explosions and possibly at these various ballistic missile sites. So, you know, you can imagine, can't you, is that a factory building weapons in Israel was bombed and attacked, that there would be enormous amounts of news around it, but not when it's in Iran.
Well, that's right. And the reason the Iranians are playing it down, and it's also maybe the case that Hezbollah will play down what they think that what they know about what's happened in Beirut, is because they're just trying to get through to November without a war. Because it's possible that Trump may then be removed, and the pressure will be released a bit. As you can imagine, if you are a leader in one of these organizations or one of the countries that are under this kind of assault, you're trying to avoid getting into an all-out war, because that's a disaster for you. So you basically have to suck up an awful lot of punishment without retaliation. The Syrian army would be absolutely within its rights in international law to attack the air bases from which these planes flew out today to attack their troops. That's what if somebody attacked the Akrotiri base in Cyprus, unless it was the locals like Aoka B, the British would then go and attack the base where the people had fired the missiles from or the planes had flown from. But the Syrians can't. The Lebanese can't. There's one rule for them and another rule for us, but that's the way it is.
An official Israeli military source denied carrying out the attack, which is interesting because they actually said, we did not carry out this attack. That implies it was actually an attack. So that's quite an interesting angle to all of this. Mm. But anyway, Martin, in summary, do you think how much will countries like Lebanon, Syria and Iran, what sorts of massive attacks, if this is an attack, will they be prepared to accept before they start to strike back?
Well, they'll accept virtually anything because they haven't got any options. They really don't want to have a major war. You saw the Iranians practice. They had a fake aircraft carrier and they bombed it the other day on video so the Americans can see, this is what we can do to your aircraft carriers. They're doing everything they can to do what you might call, if you're you're a butterfly or a beetle, you've got all these poisonous colours and you're trying to show them the poisonous colours. If you eat me, you're going to die. And that's where they're at with their strategy. And they can't afford to be silly about it. Yeah, because a major war, it will hurt the Israelis, and they, of course, are sort of by and large better off than their neighbours, and they're used to shopping and being able to go to the beach and go on foreign holidays. They will be shocked when the missiles come raining down on them. But of course, other people in the neighbourhood are very well aware of how brutal warfare is.
I mean, the other side of all of this is: do you think it will be a successful tactic to help Netanyahu and Benny Gantz stay in power?
Well, if you look at Netanyahu and Benny Gantz, it's dumb and dumber, really. There's no real forces or voices for peace left in the mainstream of Israeli politics. You've got a substantial minority of Israeli citizens who are Arab Palestinians, and if there was a peace faction in the Knesset, they would work with them to change the
But many of these demonstrators are many of these demonstrators are Jewish, Martin.
Well, yes, because Netanyahu's a crook. So what they're objecting to is him ripping off the state. which is perfectly legitimate. But those same people probably have. Benny Gantz basically was in charge of everything that happened in Gaza last year. And he presents himself as nearly as militant.
Well, hang on, what you're talking about here, because, you know, it wasn't reported that much, was literally hundreds of people being shot dead. Just simply for walking over a piece of land, and they were shot
for trying to march back towards where they used to live before they were all put in the concentration camp in Gaza.
Which is the irony here being, this is about the right to return, which of course the Zionists claim this right, but then if anyone else wants to claim it, then they shoot them dead.
Well, that's right. And, you know, we've got US imperialism with its global designs, and we've also got Israeli imperialism with its rather more regional interests, but they are very belligerent. And ultimately, of course, the belligerence of the Israelis ends up with people dying in bomb attacks in Western Europe. That's what it means. They are risking our lives with their belligerent attitude.
Okay, but in the background to all of this, of course, is the much wider conflict between the United States and China, which is, you know, basically saber-rattling militarily, but a full-on trade war is developing there. In the meantime, Martin, thanks for pointing out to me last week about this China being on its highest ever flood alert, as 38 million people have been evacuated in China. Now, I hadn't heard anything about this, but that's a lot of people to evacuate from an area which is a floodplain of a dam.
Yeah, but every year the West says that this dam's going to collapse. I've read various analyses of this. First of all,
let's just make it clear. This is called the Three Gorges Dam. It's looking at photographs of it. It does look as if parts of the dam from satellites, parts of the dam seem to be bending from above.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that's happened is they're letting water flow through the dam, because, you know, it's full, and cities downstream have been flooded. Wuhan, the so-called center of the coronavirus crisis, has been under floods this week. And the other people have suggested that it may well be, if we've got virus attacks and all these other things going on, that weather warfare may be involved here. Maybe it's possible that people can make the rain up in the mountains in Tibet particularly bad, and that puts extra pressure on
Chinese government. It's just as possible, Martin, just as possible that the design of this dam and this river wasn't quite up to the job. They didn't realise that there was going to be changes in the climate that were going to mean that the dam was going to have to allow much more water to pass through it rather than to use it for power generation.
Yeah, and apparently it hasn't really generated much power anyway. But anyway, I mean, all of these questions, I mean, one of the problems with a centralized system like China is if you get a white elephant project like building a dam, and it seems to be, you know, it really fits the bill as a sort of, you know, only China could build a dam this big, you know. But the danger with that is that you build a big dam, but it's the wrong dam and you shouldn't have built it. But anyway, even if that's the case, you're then vulnerable. And of course, in any warfare, you know, the obvious thing that the Chinese can sink any US aircraft carrier, quite obviously, the dam busters from the US can blast this dam and flood the whole of central China.
Well, maybe so they
it's,
would.
It's obviously a national security risk.
It's now vulnerable. I would hope that the Chinese are keeping a very, very close eye on this Three Gorges Dam. It's in the Hubei province.
There is a regular drumbeat of the dam's going to fall down year in, year out from anti-China people.
Yeah, but just a minute. This is on the Yangtze River in Hubei province. Beijing's admitted that it's a 2.4-kilometre span Three Gorges Dam is deformed after the record flooding. They quoted the operator, the Chinese news agency, of the world's largest hydroelectric gravity dam, saying that some non-structural peripheral parts of the dam had indeed buckled, that the dam was a pet project of the late Premier Li Peng, and a monumental pride of the nation when it blocked and diverted Asia's largest river in 1997. That was the same year that Hong Kong was handed back by the Brits. But that took place on the Yangtze River. So if this dam goes, will we know, a bit like Beirut, will we know if it's an accident or deliberate?
Well, I mean, it might be an accident, or as I say, it might be deliberate. But don't forget, as I just mentioned earlier, Pompeo said we're no longer going to tolerate China. Now, if you're going to go to war with China, you've got to break their legs, knock their dam down, blame them for what's going on with the Uyghur minority, stir things up in Hong Kong, have a trade war, try and shut down Huawei, arrest their people. It's a pattern's beginning to appear here. And, of course, what they're doing is trying to push the Communist Party into a corner so they then lash out and then they can say, oh, look what they're doing. Blah, blah, blah. And it's reckless stuff considering how integrated China is with the world economy. But there you go. These people think like that. It's 19th century realpolitik with 21st century weapons. Absolutely bonkers, but there we are.
Well, yesterday was 75 years since the dropping of the bomb on Hiroshima. On this program, we have looked at all sorts of conspiracy theories or actual evidence, in fact, that the bombs that were dropped on Nagasaki and Hiroshima by the United States Air Force in July 1940, or was it August, actually? I think it was, 1945. The beginning of August, were in fact including some uranium which had been gotten from the Nazi uranium enrichment program. Anyway, that's a fascinating tale in itself, but in a way peripheral, because Martin, we're looking now at the expansion of nuclear weapons. All countries, China, Russia, possibly even the Israelis, but certainly the US and the NATO countries that have nuclear weapons, like France, for example, are upgrading their nuclear weapons. And in the background, we've got bubbling along, haven't we, the increase in nuclear power, nuclear energy, with the Chinese and the French building a nuclear power station called Hinkley C. What do you make of the way this is all going? Because, you know, for example, after Fukushima, the Germans cancelled their nuclear program completely. They said this is a completely crazy technology, effectively. It's far too expensive. We're going to get rid of it completely after Fukushima. So what do you make of the way this is all going? It seems now that we're supposed to be expanding. There's even a new China-only station, nuclear power station they're applying for in Bradwell, which has been closed for some years, down in Suffolk as well.
Well, I mean, you've got to make some distinction between military nukes and civilian nukes. I mean, there's obviously a massive amount of overlap. I mean, civilian nuclear energy basically only developed as a cover for military uses. So for example,
Iran is planning Canadian to build nuclear weapons. Is Iran planning to build a nuclear weapon?
No, I don't think they are, because there's no strategic purpose to it. Even if they had one, it wouldn't help them. That what they're doing is they are preparing to fight, but they've actually admit the top religious leadership has said that nuclear weapons are un-Islamic. They've issued fatwas against them. They've always maintained that what they want is civilian nuclear power. And of course, all the huffing and puffing, the Israelis have not signed the non-proliferation treaty, the Iranians have, and they've accepted all sorts of inspections. The Israelis won't sign the treaty because they've got loads of nuclear weapons and they're not going to give them up. And of course, the Logan Act in the US says that any country that develops nuclear weapons unofficially should have complete sanctions on them, which is why the Israelis never admit openly that they've got these nuclear weapons, although we know they have them because of Mordecai Vanunu's revelations some years ago. And you know, the danger of any, you know, there's so many things to go wrong here, isn't there? Leaving aside the fact that the waste from these nuclear power plants is going to be a problem for generations and generations to come. It's only made to seem viable as long as the waste is magicked out of the equation.
That's right, the waste will go along with the debt, won't it? That would also... But anyway, I thought we'd have a chat with Dr. Chris Busby, who's been a major figure around the UK in helping people who have been, for example, living near nuclear power stations who have caught the disease leukemia, particularly childhood leukemia clusters, So on Hiroshima Day, that is to say 75 years after the exploding of the first atomic bomb, let's have a listen to what Chris Busby has to say, but particularly about the way that we now measure whether or not nuclear power stations are safe.
This is a decision people have to make on the basis of their ideas about whether nuclear is carbon dioxide free and whether it should be used in order to have a low carbon footprint with regard to climate change. And so a lot of the greenies have now decided that climate change is a much bigger threat than the radiation that's likely to come from the nuclear industry. And of course they're entitled to do that. But they should do it on the basis of the real truth about the health effects of releases from these nuclear sites, rather than some, you know, pie in the sky nonsense that's peddled by the nuclear industry and also then parroted by people like George Monbiot, you know, who actually knows nothing at all about radiation or radiation biology or radiation risk or anything. I mean, and also other people, there's another guy, Mark something or another, who embraces nuclear on the basis of totally crazy ideas about the way about the risks from it. Now, I'll say a few things about the risks from it, because that's something that I've studied quite a lot and published quite a lot about. And those risks were originally studied by the Atomic Bomb Casualty Committee, who followed the people who were exposed at Hiroshima and Nagasaki for their lifespan. It's called the Lifespan Study. So anyway, the point is that the risk model, what emerges from this is that the risk model that they obtained from doing that big study is completely wrong. It's just totally and completely wrong by orders of magnitude, by factors of between 1,000 and 10,000, which is why when you go and study people living near nuclear sites like Hinkley and Bradwell, which I have studied, you know, and published in the peer-reviewed literature, you find excess risk of cancer, particularly female breast cancer. Also, I looked at Trasvenneth nuclear power station in Wales. Again, we had a fivefold excess of breast cancer in women. But you find that there are excess risks of childhood leukemia in just about every single nuclear site that anybody has studied. But they continue to deny causation on the basis of this Hiroshima study.
Okay, so what would you say? You know, how do you, would you counter those arguments? What evidence have you got that this study is so wrong?
Well, the Hiroshima study is based on, or was based, it started in 1952. I mean, it was an epidemiological study of about 80,000 people who were exposed at the time of the bomb. And they were originally to be compared with a control group, people who weren't in the city at the time of the bomb, in order to see how many cancers there were. And then to see how many cancers there were on the basis of what dose they got from the immediate explosion. And so this study carried on. It was funded by the Americans. The first thing you could say about it, which is what Alice Stewart said, is that it was a survivor population. So by 1952, when they assembled all these people, an awful lot of people who'd been exposed to the radiation had died. But anyway, putting that to one side, You can then look at these people and see how many cancers they got according to how far they were from the explosion. Now, the explosion produces gamma rays and neutrons, external radiation, and that's absorbed by the people's bodies that live there. And if they're really close to it, when it went off, they were just incinerated. Then if they're about 500 meters a kilometer away, some of them survived and then went on to get cancer. But after 2 kilometers, nobody got any dose at all, because that's when the radiation runs out of steam. So what the study did is it looked at the dose according to their distance from when the bomb went off, and it compared that to the number of cancers they got. But by 1973, suddenly they discovered that the people who were not in the city, you know, the control group, started to show up with lots of cancers, and they said, well, this is impossible. I mean, they weren't even exposed to the radiation. So they kicked out the control group. They said, this must be a false control group. So they took it out altogether. And after that, they just compared high dose to medium dose to low dose, and they drew a straight line through the whole thing. And that gave them the number of cancers you get per unit dose. But there was a huge problem. And the problem was that bomb, when it exploded, sucked an awful lot of water vapor up into the air. And then the bomb constituents themselves, the uranium that the bomb was made of, and 95% of it hadn't fissioned, it was only 5% that fissioned, turned into particles, and that those particles fell on the ground as black rain. And this black rain fell for at least 7 or 8 kilometers away from the bomb, from the detonation. So in around about 2000, 2005, that sort of time, studies began to show that people who were nowhere near the bomb were getting cancer. Okay, the control group people had got high levels of cancer. They weren't even in the city. They just came in afterwards. So obviously those people were exposed to something that were giving them cancer. And this something was the black rain. Well, secret documents that I saw when I was doing the court case, and I'm not allowed to talk about it apart from saying that, you know, the fact that those documents exist are there in the transcripts of the court case, which are public data. They can be taken forward to show that the concentration of uranium inside the bomb in the black rain was extremely high, that the doses from the black rain were extremely high. And the reason I can say this is that in 2014, an American document from Rocky Flats, where they processed this uranium into the bomb material, was released for public consumption in 2014. It was a 1976 document. And when you look at it, you can see that the amounts of a missing uranium isotope called uranium-234 were absolutely enormous. They were absolutely enormous. So what happened is that the study, the Hiroshima study, is made completely false by the fact that the cancers were not caused by the external radiation. They were caused by the exposure to internal uranium particles from the black rain, which were in the water supply and in the dust when people were rebuilding the city from 1945 to 1950. There was huge amounts of dust because they were, like, you know, pulling all the ruins down and rebuilding it and so on. And everyone is inhaling the dust or drinking the water contaminated with this U-234. So this is big news, because what this means is that the risk model that they obtained from this Hiroshima study is completely wrong. Now, that's the same risk model that's used to argue that cancers near Hinkley Point and cancers near Bradwell — I found high levels of breast cancer near Bradwell also, and that's been published in the literature — those cancers are real, and they're caused by the radiation. They're caused by the uranium released from the stacks and other isotopes released from the stacks of the nuclear power stations environment.
Nuclear Fuels, Chris, would say that actually they don't release any uranium from the stacks, that it's all filtered out.
Yes, well, they do say that, but actually there are papers that show that just isn't true. And in fact, there was the data that they brought out for when EDF were building were applying for the license to build Hinkley Point. There was an environmental impact assessment made in which the concentrations of uranium were actually measured in the soil around the site, you know, as a sort of background to what was going to happen when they bring in the new reactor. And we analyzed — I did with Cecily Collingridge and I, she's dead now, but we analyzed that data, and we found that there was a huge number of tons of extra uranium in the soil around the site that they were, you know, around the Hinkley Point site. And that uranium was in the upper soil, so it wasn't in the lower soils, because they actually did cause. So we could show that the upper soil contained a lot more uranium than the lower soil. And this uranium had been coming from the stacks and also from being pumped out into the sea where it gets washed back. So we also had a trend with distance from the sea. So all that uranium is in the mud. And not only that, but we actually took samples and measured the uranium. And there is uranium also in the spectra that we obtain by Freedom of Information Act requests to the operators of Hinkley Point. I think maybe even to EDF, I can't remember. I know Environment Agency, that was it. So we got the data, and we could show that there was excess uranium in the mud. Now that mud is being dredged now and taken over to the Welsh side and just dumped off Cardiff, where you've got millions of people living just near all that stuff.
Well, yeah, but you see, British Nuclear Fuels, the operators of these plants, will say there is no uranium in the local environment. They'll say, actually, that uranium, Chris, stays in the reactor itself, and it just heats water up. It doesn't go anywhere. It certainly doesn't go into the atmosphere.
Well, that just isn't true. I mean, if you look at the United Nations Scientific Committee on the Effects of Atomic Radiation, the 2000 edition is the last time that they released data on the releases, their tables from 1990 to 1999. So that's 9 or 10 years of data from every nuclear site in the world. And one of the tables, you know, one of the rows in those tables has the Hinkley reactors, Hinkley A, Hinkley B. So there they are, you know. I mean, anybody can see that.
How does the uranium get through a great big steel pressure vessel? I mean, it can't just go through metal, can it?
No, of course not. But the thing is that they vent this stuff through stacks. They vent the cooling water through stacks, and the cooling water gets contaminated by leakages and broken up fuel rods and all sorts of crap. You know, I mean, it just is the case. You can see in the tables that they say particulate releases, and these particulate releases are releases of particles of uranium from the fuel rods, and they go out, they are released every year. Into the air. I mean, there they are in the tables. It's quite a lot of it, I can tell you. I mean, I can send you the tables and you can see them. There they are. So, I mean, they could say, oh, it can't come out of here because it's impossible. But whether it's impossible or not, it does.
Okay, so the latest news we've got from Hinkley is that there has been a tower that has collapsed at Hinkley, which released a dust cloud in the whole area. A spokesperson for EDF, which is building the site, said the silo suffered structural damage. And this was back on the 10th of June. Doesn't sound as if the people constructing it are really doing a very good job if they've allowed a large silo to collapse on site.
Well, there's another thing. Yes, I agree with you. And there's another thing. They're the turbines. I mean, these things have oil seals. You know, in order to drive the electricity through the turbines, you've got to have a shaft which runs through metal. And on one side of it, you get all the steam and all the stuff. And on the other side, you get the air. And the oil for those things is incinerated regularly. They have incinerators. They just burn it. So there are lots of ways in which this stuff can get out. I mean, there's the cooling ponds as well, you know. So these things get thrown into the cooling ponds, that you know, it like to cool off, you know. And then of course they go off to Sellafield to be whatever they do there, you know, recycled or turned into plutonium or whatever, you know, reprocessed. That was it. And it gets out of Sellafield, I can tell you, because we've measured it. I mean, I've measured. I tell you one thing that I did recently, which hasn't got out, is that I got an air filter from somebody living just within 5-6 kilometers of, I think maybe Covington, somewhere like that, from a vehicle. I asked them. I've been asking for vehicle air filters in order to see particles inside them, if there are any, because there's a method of looking at particles called CR39. It's a bit like a photographic method. So you put it next to the air filter membrane, and you leave it for a long time, and then you get these little tracks that you can see when you develop it with potassium hydroxide, and you can look at it through a microscope. So there was this filter that was sent to me by this person who lived near Hinkley Point, and there it is. There's a uranium part, a really seriously dangerous uranium particle in the car air filter. So if it can get into an engine air filter, it can certainly get into your lung.
So that's Dr. Chris Busby there. He's an expert on radiation, effects of radiation, particularly around nuclear power stations. Been involved in many court cases and detected what he believes, and what to a certain extent the courts have also agreed, are leukemia clusters around these places, and particularly childhood leukemia. Martin, what do you think from what you've heard there? I mean, he's in a way, I mean, he's a fascinating idea, isn't it? But someone has sent him an air filter from their car to check, and he's found uranium in it.
Well, I mean, you've got to listen to it, haven't you? Nuclear power clearly isn't safe. I mean, the nuclear power has been developed on the back of nuclear weapons. The Indian nuclear bombs, what they did is they bought CANDU nuclear reactors from Canada, so they were basically peaceful nuclear reactors. But they only bought them so that they could develop nuclear material for bombs. And, you know, A.Q. Khan but obviously developed the Pakistani bomb on a different basis. People have known ever since Hiroshima and John Hershey's reports that nuclear radiation is just terribly bad for you, and it lasts for thousands of years, and basically to be avoided if you can.
One of the interesting things about Chris Busby is he pointed to George Monbiot there. They were both members of the Green Party, as I was actually back in the 1990s. And George Monbiot, when it came to the time of the Fukushima disaster, actually published in The Guardian a hatchet job on Chris Busby. So they had formerly been colleagues, but obviously Chris Busby did not have a column in The Guardian. And George Monbiot really attacked him, basically saying that, you know, we need nuclear power. Interesting that that happened just after the Fukushima accident, where the nuclear industry was so much in question. Indeed, the German authorities decided to cancel their program completely.
Yeah, well, let's bring in the Stuxnet virus here, a cyber attack on the Iranian nuclear program, which caused all of their centrifuges to blow out. The Israelis and the Americans have basically all but said, yeah, that we did that. Wasn't it brilliant? But of course, it then got into the world's computer systems and may have had a role in what happened at Fukushima. Obviously, Fukushima is an absolute disaster. You've got loads of radioactive water being leached into the Pacific. We could mention, if we're doing nuclear topic, the bombings of Bikini Atoll in the 1950s, eventually with hydrogen bombs by the Americans, and huge plumes of radioactive dust were allowed to flow over the Marshall Islands, and loads of people subsequently were exposed. lots of military people.
Martin, there were also, for example, whole loads of fishermen that were also exposed, Japanese fishermen. And there are people who say that these were actually deliberately not warned of the test so that they could be part of the test.
Well, you may say so. The original bombing, they were testing what they were doing. I mean, all the justification for it about, you know, there would have to have been a major assault on Japan. Well, that's debatable. Japan was completely surrounded and was under an economic blockade. And what was really probably significant is that the Russians had declared war on Japan and they were moving through Manchuria towards Korea, and they'd have ended up in Korea. And then if the Americans and the British say, well, we don't want to lose the casualties to invade Japan, the Russians will say, well, we've already taken 20 million. We can take another 2 million, but we're having Japan. And at that point, the bombs are dropped. The Japanese don't want to be taken over by the Russians, and the Americans come in and with all the consequences that we know. I do think, actually, that going on about they didn't have to use nuclear weapons. Tokyo had been bombed with conventional explosives not long before, and 100,000 people died. There is no real difference in killing people, but the difference, I suppose, about radioactivity is I'm quite sure it's probably not safe in Hiroshima even today, all these years later, whereas in Tokyo, people probably are, even though they were incinerated in 1945.
I mean, some people have said, Martin, there was no strategic need, as you say there, to use the atomic weapon on Japan, and also that this was a deliberate test on Japanese people on Hiroshima Day 75 years ago that didn't need to take place. Indeed, some have even suggested that President Roosevelt, who was said to be against the use of the atomic bomb on Japan, died literally just at the end of the war in Europe, a couple of months before the bombs were dropped.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's still lots of debate about how the decision was made. Quite a lot of the top brass in the US, Eisenhower, for example, said there was no need for that, and he ultimately became president of the US. I think the real message was being sent to the Russians. Look what we've got. Don't forget. And also... the recklessness, you know, we're quite prepared. And we know that a plan was cooked up by Churchill and others to atomic bomb the Soviet Union's major cities. And they were working on that. So it's probably just as well that the Soviet spy network was extremely good. So they knew all about this stuff at the Potsdam Conference, when Truman said to Stalin, "We've got a new weapon, you know," and he said, "Oh well, I hope you use it on the Japanese." And people who were standing around thought, well, Stalin doesn't seem to understand what this is, but apparently Stalin knew exactly what it was because he got his own scientists working on exactly that, and of course lots of his scientists were getting information directly from the people working on the atomic bomb and the Manhattan Project. Many of whom were communists.
From Klaus Fuchs, who did his studying in Bristol, by the way.
Yeah.
Also, on this very topic of whether or not it was a good idea or necessary to use the atom bomb back in August 1945, probably one of the best books on it is by a guy called Gar Alperovitz. That's A-L-P-E-R-O-V-I-T-Z, Gar Alperovitz. And that's called The Decision to Use the Atomic Bomb. And that really does include all sorts of interesting angles on those arguments which were used and counter-arguments which were put by, particularly by politicians in the military and in the United States, about whether or not this was going to be necessary. Of course, we know, Martin, that actually if a weapon has been developed, those that have developed it would rather like to see it used in anger, because that gives them an idea of how useful it might be in the future in a subsequent war.
Absolutely. And, you know, there was no basically Hiroshima and Nagasaki, 67 cities in Japan, including Tokyo, have been reduced to rubble. But these two cities have been left so that they could be atomic bombed with no other damage to them, so that they could then see exactly what the damage was when you just use an atomic bomb with nothing else involved. So don't forget that many of the people who developed the atomic bomb were profoundly anti-Nazi people, and they developed it because they feared that Hitler would get it. But once Hitler had been defeated, they were not happy at all about it being used on Japan. But as you know, realpolitik doesn't work like that.
What do you make of the research that I've been doing and others have been doing on the Nazi enriched uranium program? Because it certainly, with arrests in Germany of people who are in possession of nuclear material that they won't tell the authorities where they found it. We've also had the German government actually itself coming out and saying there was a nuclear enrichment program, which they previously had denied. And then, of course, there's the testimony of various people involved in this submarine, U-234. Funnily enough, we just heard about an isotope of uranium called U-234. This is a German submarine called U-234, which was heading across the Atlantic, containing, allegedly, large amounts of enriched uranium, and also the fuses necessary, the infrared fuses necessary for the plutonium bomb. So there is some evidence for there being a German nuclear program which deliberately wasn't used in order to make it a bargaining chip with the Allies at the end of the war.
I think that's a very interesting thesis. And as you know, deals were being done at the end of the war with senior Nazi figures, not Hitler. Nobody told him anything. And it's quite possible that some of the material that was dropped on Japan had been developed in the Nazi nuclear program and given to the Western powers as part of a deal Bormann, as we know, ended up in Argentina and continue to operate.
Well, it's to allow safe passage.
Under the cover of Western intelligence services.
A lot of these war criminals were very concerned about what was going to happen to them at the end of the war. They needed to buy their safe passage at the end, didn't they?
Yeah. So there's a lot of evidence to suggest that sort of thing went on. And when the Allies took over in Japan, the Kempeitai and the power structure, they'd carried out loads of biological and chemical warfare experiments on lots of different people. And they said, well, if you want this material, you're going to have to let us off. And if you let us off, we'll give it you all. And that was the deal that was done. And that we're going to move on now, I think, not to talk about biological warfare labs, but I mean, the Western biological warfare and chemical warfare program came from that era. And it's still continuing.
Well, I mean, yes, you're right. We are going to move on to look at Diliana Gatancheva, who I spoke to this week, Martin, and she was really wanted to talk about a discovery that she made during the so-called civil war in Syria. Really, this is a proxy war that was waged by the NATO countries against Syria, an attempt at a regime change, which was blocked mainly by the intervention of the Russians. And she wanted to talk to me about her website called Arms Watch, and particularly what caused her to start publishing there and to set up the site. And this is about arms smuggling into Turkey and Syria during that Syrian so-called civil war, which she was saying was completely actually fueled by NATO, not in just in terms of arms, but also in terms of money and specific units and individuals that were being sent in to as an attempt to regime change Syria, basically a mercenary army sponsored by NATO. So let's have a listen to her now.
In December of 2016, I was in Aleppo in northern Syria reporting on the Battle of Aleppo when the terrorists retreated from their positions. I was able to get inside Al-Qaeda warehouses full of heavy weapons, and I was able to film the identification marks of these weapons and their country of origin, and later on to trace back these weapons to the country of origin of these weapons and their original supplier. In this case, it was the government of the United States, Saudi Arabia as well. And the manufacturer was my country, Bulgaria. I filmed 122-millimeter Grad rockets originating from Bulgaria. And I found these weapons in a warehouse of Al-Qaeda in Syria. I traced back these weapons, and later on I received leaked documents about 350 diplomatic flights from Eastern Europe via different routes, but the final destination of these weapons was Syria or Yemen or Africa.
Did you manage to discover who was masterminding these operations?
Yes, absolutely. These flights, diplomatic flights, they were diplomatic and they were performed by the Azeri state-run company Silkway Airlines. So in order for flights to be diplomatic and to receive and to be granted diplomatic clearance, a state, in this case Azerbaijan, must apply for diplomatic clearance. So in this case, we are talking about a whole international weapons shipment network involving the governments of many countries, with Azerbaijan being I wouldn't say the organizer, because this air company, Silkway Airlines, was chartered by the governments of the United States, Saudi Arabia, and the United Emirates. And these weapons originating from the Balkans or other countries in Eastern Europe, including my country, Bulgaria, these weapons were transported on these diplomatic flights to different locations, but they were later on smuggled to Syria. And I filmed a lot of weapons in the hands of terrorists in Syria, and I traced back these same weapons to their original supplier. It was, in my case, it was the government of the EU Special Operations Command, or the government of the United States, and also Saudi Arabia, their Ministry of Defense. These two governments supplied weapons to militants in Syria, and I will use the word terrorists because this was al-Nusra Front operating in Aleppo, and al-Nusra Front at that point was the Syrian affiliate of al-Qaeda in Syria.
Okay, Silkway Airlines, Martin, and Special Operations Command. Now, the Silkway Airlines, if you have a look at them, they basically operate the old Soviet-style equipment. But, of course, Azerbaijan is, although it's a former Soviet republic, it's now very much more friendly to the West. So it looks as if NATO have decided that they're going to use some of these newly arrived NATO nations in order to create a smuggling operation to support their proxy mercenary troops trying to overthrow governments.
Yeah, and of course, one of the ways, it's the same, if you remember in Operation Cyclone, and you remember the film Charlie Wilson's War, they needed to have Soviet bloc weaponry, because the Mujahideen fighting in Afghanistan, if they'd all had M16s or SA-80 rifles, it would have been obvious it was arming them. So they needed to get Soviet-era weapons. And, of course, the Israelis provided those because they captured a hell of a lot of Soviet tanks and military equipment in their various wars with Syria and Egypt. And the same will probably be the case, you know, the militants inside Syria, and many of them are not Syrian at all, of course, they would be using the same sort of weaponry as their opponents, the Syrian Arab Army. And so they could, you know, plausibly claim that they'd captured this weaponry from the enemy. But of course, she's got drilled down to the detail there. All of this weaponry has actually got, you know, it's got serial numbers on it and so forth. And basically what they've done is they've gone around East European countries, hoovered all this stuff up and smuggled it in to give to their protégés, Al-Qaeda. And, of course, it was their protégés, Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, and their protégés, Al-Qaeda in Syria. And anybody listening to this show doesn't realise by now that Al-Qaeda is a front organisation for the Saudi intelligence services and therefore for the Western intelligence services, just hasn't been paying attention.
So the activities of Silkway Airlines have been mainly in Afghanistan. They've had two crashes, one in 2011 and one in 2016, in southern Afghanistan, another one at Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan, and also down in Chad. But these people seem to be quite clearly, I mean, I just think it's useful to know which airlines, and this is a cargo airline, have been taking this equipment. And fascinating thing I think she said there was looking at the end user certificates. So a lot of this equipment was manufactured in the former Soviet Union, Eastern European countries, which are now part of NATO. They are making these weapons, and then they're exporting them, with the so-called end user being the United States. But then, funnily enough, they're ending up in the hands of al-Nusra and al-Qaeda.
Well, yes, and she's done a very good job of documenting it, and she's also paid a pretty high price for it. I mean, she's probably one of the best investigative journalists operating on the planet today. But her life isn't easy because the people who don't want her to do what she does are making her life difficult.
What about Special Operations Command? They're the people she was saying effectively masterminding this whole operation.
Yeah, well, that's the way you do it, isn't it? The politicians only need to know what they need to know. Meanwhile, you get on with doing what you're doing. And even if you get caught, you just say, well, nothing to do with me, Gov. That's how it works. I mean, so everybody knows.
Special Operations Command, I think, is worthy of note, actually, because they are they sit alongside the entire "we want to dominate the world" unified command structure, where we've got things like AFRICOM, which is the American military dominating Africa. We've got EUCOM, which is the American military dominating the EU. We've got CENTCOM, which is the American military dominating the Middle East. We've got SOUTHCOM, which is the American military dominating South America. So they've got, and in fact, they've got commands for all parts of the world, including many of them actually based in Florida, some, but actually some of the most important ones based in Stuttgart in Germany, these commands. But Special Operations Command straddles the entire world. It is the unified combatant command charged with overseeing all special operations in the component commands of Army, Marine Corps, Navy and Air Force of the whole of the US armed forces all over the world. So an interesting little unit we don't hear all that much about.
Well, apart from all of the kind of, you know, SAS, Who Dares Wins, Green Berets, all of the kind of, you know, Hollywood style stuff that we get told about these great heroes who infiltrate. We can't tell you everything that they do, but it's a good job they're there. Otherwise, the terrorists might kill us in our beds. And of course they are in fact embedded with the worst terrorists on the planet. The Saudis are they've been supporting militant Islamist extremism for years and years and years and years and years. But nevertheless, why if 19 hijackers on 9/11 were from Saudi Arabia, why did we invade Afghanistan? And the answer is, of course, because Saudi Arabia is in on all of this, although ultimately they may be dropped by their handlers like everybody else. So this is the way the world works.
So the commander of Special Operations Command is Gregory A. Smith. He's a U.S. Air Force CCM, whatever that stands for. And they're based at MacDill Air Force Base in Tampa, Florida, in the United States, is their offices. But, you know, it's interesting, I think, that when a little bit of investigative journalism like this, just very well aimed by Diliana there, is what she's really uncovered, is cast iron proof, cast iron evidence that actually the supplying of weapons to the Free Syrian Army and the various factions within Syria trying to overthrow President Assad was directly from the United States Special Operation Command itself, from the Pentagon and the US military.
And all in complete defiance of international law. So everybody involved should A, be arrested, B, be prosecuted, C, sent to prison, and D, in the United States where they have the death penalty, maybe they should be fried. But none of that's going to happen. But of course, ultimately, what goes around comes around. And it's, you know, the assassinator of Soleimani, the guy who gave that order, it's reported in some quarters that he died in an air crash in Afghanistan. So, you know, if you get and Le Mesurier, the British intelligence agent involved setting up the white helmets, he committed suicide, apparently, in Turkey. I mean, if you're involved in these kind of games, you and your family are targets.
If anyone listened to the full version of the interview, which we played a couple of weeks ago with Alex Craner, Martin, they would have heard him saying that it's actually a very dodgy and a dangerous thing to do, to create, to do an assassination like that of Soleimani, because you have to kill the people who've done the assassination, and you also have to kill the people who've killed the people who've done the assassination. Otherwise, there is every possibility that it will leak out and that you may be prosecuted in the future for it. So it's a bit of a risky business.
Well, in the
Soleimani high-level assassination.
In the Soleimani case, they boasted about it, so that's not quite the case. It's illegal. They should go to the International Criminal Court for that, shouldn't they? They won't, because the US isn't part of the International Criminal Court. They're not part of the UN Law of the Sea. They're not part of the Chemical Weapons and Biological Weapons Conventions. But they claim to be the international community, even though they don't participate in any of these international courts and forums. And the attitude of that's because that the laws are for others, not for them. And okay, that's the reality.
So finally tonight, we got to look at the Hollywood producer. This is a guy called John Paul Rice, and he has commented this week on the complete lack of coverage in the mass media, which, of course, this is a major problem. Then we've got enormous news stories breaking, but gagging orders, taboo or whatever, nobody is covering this at all. And in this case this week, it's the release of the court papers, which were supposed to have been sealed, then unsealed, and then sealed again after the judge in question had her son murdered. And in this case, these papers have just simply not been reported on, even though there's a wealth of information about a massive extortion network that was being run through Ghislaine Maxwell and Jeffrey Epstein in the United States. So here he is. This is John Paul Rice talking about... really, I mean, he starts off by talking about his film, his own film, which they made as a feature film about the paedophile scandals called A Child's Voice. And then he goes on to say something about his own knowledge of these kinds of child sex rings still going on and still being protected by the mass media, which are there going on in Hollywood right now.
When the Me Too movement started in 2017, I reached out to several of my female actress friends who were prominent in LA. You would know them by name. Many of them you would know by just their look, because you go, oh, that was her in that movie or that movie. And I said, well, what about the children? What about the children? And the response was, we know. But they were silent on it. And it destroyed me, because it destroyed my illusion of what rights, human rights, were. children's rights were. This is a child abuse system that we have been living in for a very long time, and it's been allowed to go on. And I will not be silent about this because it affects every single one of us. The people on television who smile at you, who tell you stories, who give you news, are the ones who hide all of this from us. They are not talking about the real issues. They are distracting you with division issues. This is a unification issue. When the Maxwell files came out 48 hours ago, I went on MSNBC, I went on CNN.com, and I looked at every single one of their headlines, and there was no mention of it whatsoever. They were talking about John Lewis's funeral. They were talking about Obama versus Trump, all of the bullshit that you and I hear every single day. And it doesn't matter what side of the political equation you're on this. This is a child issue. This is a human issue. This is not a political issue. It has nothing to do with left versus right, Democrat versus Republican, liberal versus conservative, or anything you are or you identify with as in between. We are faced with a crisis of consciousness among the leadership of our banking institutions, of our media corporations, of the Hollywood entertainment industry, of the music industry. This is not about a bunch of young women who were having sex with older men and make it about a bunch of perverts. They raped and tortured these girls against their own free will, no matter whether they paid them or not. If you read the articles and you listen to what Ghislaine Maxwell said about the girls that she picked up in West Palm Beach's trailer parks, she was asked, what about the young girls? What are we going to do to them? What's going to happen to them? She said, they are trash. They are nothing. That's a direct quote from the New Yorker. When I went and looked at edge.org, which you can find out was a multi-billionaire club of people that was financed by Jeffrey Epstein, you can go to edge.org today, look up under people, and go to G. You'll see Bill Gates on there as a contributing member of that organization. And you'd have to go back in the Wayback Machine and Internet Archives to look at all the other people. Jeffrey Epstein was right on there. Marina Abramovich is on there. Paul Allen was on there. All the heads of major industries were on there. And if you start reading some of the articles, one of which I have a direct link to that I will share with anybody who DMs me, there is a direct quote on there that said, indeed, human beings are, in our youngest years, among the most useless creatures in all of the animal kingdom. This is how they view children, through science. This is their expression. These are people who have no ground to tell you what to think, what to do. So when they get up there and they start espousing their views on social justice or whatever the hell it is, know that you're hearing a controlled and scripted dialogue that is going through a filter by people who are very powerful, who hold a lot of money, and they are controlling and conditioning all of these people through pedophilia.
Well, he's a Hollywood producer, maker of the film A Child's Voice, John Paul Rice there. He's not name-dropping particularly, Martin, but he's saying that this is actually endemic in one of the most powerful parts of the global media, that is Hollywood.
Yeah, well, the whole point about the Epstein case is it's being presented to the general population as, oh, isn't it nasty, these perverted blokes that are...
Prince Andrew, Epstein.
Yeah, and Prince Andrew, of course, because everybody's heard of him. But, of course, what it is it's an intelligence operation whereby the heads of industries, senior politicians, anybody who's anybody is dirtied up. They get them to have sex with underage boys and girls, and then they're in the pocket of the intelligence agencies concerned. And Epstein and Maxwell, I mean, you know, it's pretty obvious which intelligence agency they work for. It was the Israeli intelligence agency, Mossad, who boast about their success in controlling events, but then are suddenly terribly reticent when everybody says, well, what do you mean by that? I mean, there's a book in the bookshops now, you know, Rise Up and Kill First, which is a load of boasting about Mossad assassinations. And then at the same time, the Israeli state says, but we're the only democracy in the Middle East, and we abide by the rule of law.
Well, we were just now talking about Netanyahu trying to get a war with Iran started and possibly the attack on Beirut being part of all of that. Obviously, if you've got a hard drive with loads of rich and powerful people's effectively control files on all of them with criminal acts that they've been doing with children, that's actually going to make your life a little bit easier in getting a war started.
Certainly is. And that's what's been going on for years. I mean, as we know in this country, the deputy director of MI6, Hayman, he left a package on a bus, child pornography. Police went round, arrested him. And of course, he was let off because he was the deputy director of MI6. And you've got to imagine that the culture inside the intelligence services is one of blackmail. And, that's the strategy, isn't it? And, of course, that allows you to push things in all sorts of directions, doesn't it?
I mean, say even in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, that many people who were in the intelligence services were effectively above the law as they are now today. In fact, they boast about it today, MI5 and MI6 being above the law. That back in those days, this was a convenient cover for people who were homosexuals. For example, nowadays, of course, that's not a crime, but back in those days it was. But they were used, and they themselves, though, would, of course, have been very vulnerable to blackmail. The very people who are supposed to be guiding and guarding us against political interference. So it does seem as if that was a whole dysfunctional system, and probably still is.
Yeah, and I think the idea that they did this because they're homosexuals is not the point at all. It's they basically involved in illegal activities of blackmail, and it's been integrated with organised crime. I mean, Whitney Webb's stuff about this, about the background to the Epstein case, is excellent. People should read it. And this goes back to the 40s and the 30s. And, you know, the organised criminals blackmail senior police officers, public figures, anybody. And, of course, it's a policy of blackmailing everybody. It doesn't do any harm to have a video or a photograph of somebody doing something illegal. And as long as the people know that you've got that, you don't even have to use it. And you don't just go after individual targets either. You want to sweep them all up, which is why Epstein seems to be total buddies with Bill Clinton and with Trump. Because in actual fact, if you're an intelligence operation, you want dirty stuff on all of them, don't you?
Also, what he's describing there really is evil. It's talking about treating children as if they're the most useless animals in the world.
Yeah, well, you've got to understand it from their point of view. As you say, homosexuality is no longer illegal. And if you out somebody as a homosexual, it's not going to cause that much of a shock. Whereas, of course, on the other hand, paedophilia is illegal, and for good reason. And, if you go to prison as a paedophile, you have a pretty hard time. And basically, it's a very effective blackmail tool, isn't it?
It is. Also, I would say one of the things I will, I mean, we've done a bit of it there, but I will put the Ghislaine Maxwell PDF of her court documents, which were unsealed and then resealed again. But, I mean, none of that has been reported on by the mass media. But I'll put those up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk if anyone fancies looking through them or passing them on to someone that might find them useful in some sort of criminal prosecution, because I think this is one of the most important cases we've ever seen. And the idea that the judicial process can be just messed about and interfered with in this case is just certainly not acceptable. It already has been, quite clearly, with the almost certain murder of Jeffrey Epstein and his inability to testify. But then we know, don't we, that Martin, really, what they're really interested in is those hard drives with the child sex tapes on them from Epstein and Maxwell's properties. They're not really interested in what happens to Ghislaine Maxwell or Jeffrey Epstein themselves.
No. Well, as I said earlier, if you get involved in these games, you can end up dead, like Le Mesurier in Turkey, who supposedly committed suicide by jumping off a two-story building. He obviously knew too much for somebody. And, it may be that Maxwell will protect herself by saying, I'll tell you everything that we did as long as you don't prosecute me. I don't know. But it's quite likely that she may end up dead as well, eh?
Okay, and finally, just to say, I shall be down at the Fountains in Bristol City Centre on Sunday, I think it is, at 2. I've been invited down there. I don't know how much publicity has been done for it to speak about the pandemic, which I won't just be talking about the pandemic. I'll be talking about a few other things as well if I get the chance. And that's an event apparently organised by Piers Corbyn. So we'll see how that one goes. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Download our MP3s and you can listen in the car or anywhere you like. I'll put a few extra full-length interviews up this week, particularly the one we did in the first second hour with Chris Busby, the full version of that, and maybe one or two others as well, because you know, we haven't got time to do all of these things all the time each week. In fact, we're way running over time as usual. But anyway, you'll find this show's podcast, story links and comment page, and our contact details, and BCFM's contact details for that matter, at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. He's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the politics show live stream at the old time of 5 o'clock next Friday. And you can download it a couple of hours later at thisweek.org.uk and on Radio 4 All. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down. I'm gonna go to the hospital.
Another wonderful record. It's been a great week for records. I look forward to playing that next summer at festivals at dizzying volume, if there are festivals and if I'm invited to do them. New Order, of course, but that's been reinvented, really, by Fluke.